welcome to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always
by a very white guy.
And you are very white.
I'm extra white. Indeed. Warning, Joma, I'm really, really white today.
We have...
My whiteness is on 11.
Is it on fleek?
Yeah, my whiteness is on fleek.
That's never good. Never good.
Well, I feel like with two women of color, I you'll rein me in.
Yeah,
well, I feel okay.
We'll handle that. As a very white guy just mentioned, we have a very special guest on today, the one and only Ijeoma Olowu. How are you doing, Ijeoma?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
We are so excited to have you on the show. Like, seriously, you don't even know. I don't know if you heard the episode where I reenacted your tweets.
I'm white.
When someone called you
white. I did, and it was funny too, actually, because you sounded just like everyone's like, God, you sound so white. And you nailed it. You nailed my mixed girl in Seattle voice. Right there.
I
got it down.
I bring her to a lot of white spaces, so she's familiar with white women voice.
Yeah, I channeled it really good. I had my like full Becky mode. I was really in the pipe.
Yeah, but I would say I feel like, and maybe I'm just, you know, this is me selfishly, like I feel like we discovered you, kind of. You know, I know your star has been on the rise. And, you know, we've been watching, you know, you've been all over the place. You're on The Guardian. You're doing writing full time. And I feel like a little bit like we knew her when a little bit. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. I said my whiteness is on fleek today. So maybe that's I'm appropriating your success. I don't know. But
well, in case you've been living under a rock online, our guest today, Ijeoma, is a Seattle-based writer. Her work on race, feminism, and parenthood has appeared in The Guardian, Huffington Post, Time Magazine, New York Magazine, and more. And she actually really spends most of her days yelling on Twitter, which is my favorite thing to watch. Mm. And so we welcome her to the show. And so, yes, thank you so much for being here and just coming to chop it up with us a little bit and talk about all the fucked up shit that's been going on, because it's been a lot.
No shortage.
Lord.
It has, yes.
It's been way too much, way too much. If you're joining us for the first time, you can find the show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John, that's J-A-W-N. Or you can check out our website, interracialjohn.com. Of course, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, again, at Interracial John, that's J-A-W-N.
And, you know, before we get into the news, there's something I got to do.
What's that?
Oh yeah.
Uh-oh.
It happened.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. It's a 5-star motherfucking review. It happened. It totally, totally happened. I'm pumped. So, 5-star review now. Nikki524. Thank you, Nikki524. She says, on iTunes, no less. That's a 5-star on iTunes. I love hearing Leslie and Drew's hot takes on current events and the overall madness that surrounds those of us who care on a daily basis. The hosts have amazing chemistry and are a must listen for anyone who wants to hear the real.
Oh, thanks, you, Nikki. 524. Oh, that's so sweet.
We appreciate the John love.
Yes, we do.
The rest of y'all,
get on it.
Side eye.
Side eye. Hard.
Mm. Mm.
Mm. We're looking at you, all of you. Okay, well, let's jump into it. Let's get started.
The news is coming on.
So, a bunch of things in the news lately. Always racially motivated, I suppose. But did you hear schools, in particular high schools, are starting to diffuse themselves of the Native American epithet, I'll just say it, Redskin. So they're getting rid of the name. A bunch of high schools are changing mascots, eliminating it. Note Dan Snyder, NFL, you're still the long, lone holdout.
Note there are high school students who can't vote that are morally further along than you are, Dan Snyder.
And we'll give it a little lifted up. Shut up. Upstate New York, Lancaster Central District School Board unanimously voted to retire the high school mascot moniker. Unanimously. So, Snyder, come on, man. It's about time. It's about time.
Totally. Where, like, you know, by the time he does it, it's not even going to matter. Like, it's almost comical if it weren't, like, actively offending people day in and day out, right? Like, I don't know if there's a better, picture of white privilege than this Redskins debate.
Yeah,
outside
of,
did you guys see the video of that dude who put on a fur coat at that meeting on race after saying that race was slouched out of the meeting?
We're gonna play it a little later.
Fur friggin' coat, man. Like, you couldn't write it. Comedy.
It's like race is just a concept, and then he puts on his fur coat and flounces away.
It was cartoonish in nature. Like, I really, it was like an SNL skit. It was so, I couldn't believe it.
Did you ever see the Daily Show when they sent the one correspondent and he got a bunch of individuals, Native Americans, and they had a wall and they were talking to like Redskins fans, and like dude had the Redskins like WWE like WrestleMania belt on and like all the Redskins gear and shit, and then this like screen or partition opens up and it's like full on like, you know, a bunch of indigenous people, and it's just comedy gold. It shouldn't be comedy gold, but these white people's face, and like the one guy's like, well, you know, now that you know, and he's like, I feel, one of them refused to sign the thing, like that his face was burned out. He like refused to sign the waiver after he found out, like he felt like it was too gotcha. But so the one person's like, you know, would you say, he's like, well, I still feel how I feel, but you know, maybe I wouldn't have worn the jacket. That was just like, it's like acknowledgement, like, I'm still going to be fucking insensitive and, you know, use this epithet, but yeah, maybe I would have left the jacket at home.
Oh my goodness. I don't even understand the holding onto it. My whole thing is like, even business wise, oh wow, look, your organization would get to sell all new merchandise to every fan that's associated with it. So to me, it's like, it is such a display of just, I'm white and I refuse to be told what to do.
There may be, and I'll proffer, but there was rumored that there was a neighbor who's a patent attorney or a trademark attorney, and Snyder and said neighbor were talking about the name and what could be a different name, and there was something really appropriate, like, you know, like the Americans or something, and whatever the name was, this neighbor trademarked it before Snyder could. Good. So I don't know if that's playing any role, but
you know what that tells me? That means he's an asshole at home too.
The thing I don't get here, too, is like, okay, just in general, speaking back to Callie, how often does even the best Redskin fan actually say Redskin during a day? Like, when we talk about, like, how, like, uncomfortable it is to, like, call it something else, like, maybe, even if you're, like, a devout Redskin fan, you average saying Redskin once a day if you count the off-season, right? Like, how, like, it's not even when people are asking that much. Like, for that one thing, you're like, oh, God, you know, for 3 seconds, I had to think of a different name, and it wasn't Redskin. Oh, the injustice, you know? It's not even, like, that typical. You know, we do things like, we say, God bless you, when people sneeze, which makes no fucking sense whatsoever, but we do it because it's polite. And yet we won't take 3 seconds to say something other than Redskin, even though it, you know, brings up the genocide of an entire people. And I don't understand that at all.
You're hit on the head. It's the epitome of privilege. And I'm not playing like devil's advocate. I think all these individuals are asinine. But the refrain is typically, you know, the history and the legacy and the, you know, it's our, you know, my kids' kids and my dad and my granddad. And what they're really saying is, I've got a whole fucking basement full of, you know, memorabilia, and it's like a whole rumpus room. I got beer taps and a mini fridge, and I got all the license plate, you know, Redskin only parking. I can't get rid of all that shit.
Yeah, but with a league that's allowed teams to, in the cloak of darkness, change states, I just don't really see it being much of an argument.
Yeah, exactly. Like, as someone who desperately misses, you know, the Sonics, right? Like, that has no hold for me. Okay.
Exactly.
I'm still pissed about that.
See? It's happened all over the place. They're just totally ridiculous.
Well, speaking of ridiculous, let's amp it up a notch. Because mayoral candidate had to apologize for performing in blackface.
Ah.
Oklahoma Mayor Bill Helton. I'll say that again. Oklahoma Mayor Bill Helton. And his excuse, I'm using like serious air quotes around excuse, is that it was satire, and it was a character that he had developed called Polyester Cotton.
With a K.
Spelled with a K. Polyester Cotton. That was his excuse. Well, it's just satire. So.
He's been hosting fundraisers and community events as this character since 2005.
Oh, yeah. Years. Almost a decade.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's amazing about that is I swear to God, just this week I made a cartoon of just like this white dude in blackface holding watermelon with a big like dollar sign necklace saying, "What? It's satire." And this guy is actually that guy.
Yeah, he really is.
Literally.
He really is.
Actually that cartoon.
Yeah. And I just
I was like, how absurd can you make this? Oh, you know, that guy. I feel bad now. Now I feel like I wasn't even original.
You got scooped.
You know what?
Exactly.
That just proves that white people can always be more racist than we can even dream up.
That's probably true.
It's a fact.
What was it you said the other day, you know, we're talking about, and I won't say whom, but a friend. And the friend... I thought of as pretty progressive and liberal and a close friend, made some remarks that were, you know, insensitive. And I was kind of like taken aback. I was really like surprised by it. And I said to Leslie, I said, "Oh man, I can't believe, you know, friend ABC said this kind of thing." And what did you say, Leslie?
I said, "You give white people entirely too much credit." Because it's true.
Yeah. Guilty.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm a race traitor. I hate my race.
I want to know exactly what the satire is. That's the like. Yeah, I don't think they understand
what is being satirized.
What exactly is being satirized? Exactly.
You know, even
they don't understand
that,
what it means.
It's like the people that decry. I want to use the N-word. Like white people that, you know, like debate and demand and you know, it's unfair. I can't use the N-word. It's like, bro, if you knew half a fraction of a tenth of what blackface really meant to people of color, yep, and what it meant to be in blackface, like literally, like black people had to go in blackface to in order to appease white audiences, and we're talking about putting on like burnt cork that would like toxically damage the skins. So they had to protect it with. I mean, just like all this shit. That if you knew even a fraction of that, you wouldn't even fucking deign to think about, much less put that shit on and dance around and fucking say it was satire.
Listen, all he knows is it's offensive. That's all he needs to know.
And you know what it really says is it fucking plays. He's an Oklahoma mayor candidate. He's been doing this shtick for a decade, raising money.
Yeah,
he's currently Elk City's commissioner.
Well, and so can I'll give one of you ladies.
And he works as a hairdresser. I just want to be clear on the multiple things that this individual does.
So we said that his excuse was it's satire and it's a character. He did pull out one other I would say explanation. Mm-hmm. Care to gander? It's from the playbook.
Well, he's got black friends, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see myself as racist. I've got great, great friends who are African American.
Of course, because that makes a whole lot of sense.
One of my friends is
black.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing too, I think that we have to understand is with my whole family, my white family is from Kansas and Oklahoma. Okay, so I know these people and I know the racial dynamics there. This dude, because he has a hair salon and knows some black people, thought he has a pet.
Yep.
Right? But what he has is a bunch of black people who will just put up with his shit because in Oklahoma, you have to put up with the shit in order to get by. Like, they hate him and they, you know, roll their eyes at everything he says. But he thought he got a pass, right? I mean, he was like, "Yeah, that's cool." And they're like, "Yeah, whatever, dude." He was like, "See, I'm one of them." And he's not.
No.
But it's something you see all the time with these dudes who are like, "I've got like five black friends."
Yeah.
And they think that they're cool, and all they know is that white supremacy forces black people to put up with them.
I'll take it up a notch, Joma. I think that interracial, the white partner in an interracial coupling, frequently thinks that they get a pass. And I would say for me just personally, I don't want to say I happily, but I say I get the opposite of a pass. I get additional scrutiny from my wife. My white privilege is constantly on check. Like there doesn't, you know, and I'm not like embarrassed by it or ashamed by it. It's just, you know, I'm white. I'm, you know, I have all the hallmarks and trappings of privilege. You know, grew up in a very wealthy town. I went to, you know, high school and graduate school and, you know, whatever. So I'm indoctrinated into a cult of supremacy and anti-blackness in ways that I don't even know and recognize. So I'm beholden to somebody to be like, "That's like having spinach in your teeth." Like I don't want to walk around a party like, you know, "Hey, what's going on?" I got like crap in my teeth. Like I'd be kind of mad at you as a friend. In the same way, like if I'm, you know, privilege on fleek, you better be like, "Whoa, Drew, come on now. What's up with that?" You better check my shit.
I will continue to handle those duties.
Happily, I know.
Happily, yeah.
This is episode 30, what? 38, 39?
39, I think.
Yeah. I think you've checked me on air a dozen plus times.
At least.
You're going to do it today because we're going to get to a segment. What are we talking about? Starbucks. because I've changed my tune.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. I did want to just mention very quickly just what's been going on at UVA, which has been really amazing work by the black student leadership there. I'm sure everyone's seen the hashtag Black UVA Demands. They pretty much shut down a panel discussion that the school put together without consulting any of the black students.
Yeah, just shout out to there was maybe about 25, 30 students in that assembly. Unbelievable.
Just
they were
insane.
Live streaming it, and they're coordinated, answer the question we asked. Just amazing. They killed it.
Yeah. So I think you can even watch it on live stream now, or on the UVA's YouTube channel. I'll try and put a link up there. But as Drew mentioned, basically anytime a question was asked that the person tried to skirt around, the entire black student assembly would raise their fist in the air and say, answer the question we asked in unison. It was just
powerful,
beautiful. And the law enforcement, they didn't even know how to handle all of this. And I will add that four people that run the black student body, the black student union, actually just decided to jump on the stage, and they just took over one of the microphones that were up there, even though they weren't invited. They were like, no. Nope,
yeah. And when they did, they had so many questions that, in fact, they demanded to, and they demanded and got it, the time of the microphone, ask all kinds of just the laser kind of questions. So that, and I don't remember her name, but there was a transgendered woman of color that also died at UVA, and they didn't go out and have a press conference. She was missing for a period of time. They didn't say anything. And now there's, a white girl who's missing from UVA. And the president of the university is on camera having a tear-filled presser. And they asked him, did you cry for this other individual, the trans woman of color? And he had to answer it. And he said no. And it was, it's great to get that narrative
out there.
Yeah.
And just reclaim the narrative.
Reclaim the narrative. That's right.
Not let them have this press opportunity and just say whatever they wanted
exactly.
to say.
Exactly.
So kudos to them. But out of that came another hashtag, which is not just UVA, which has been, for me, incredibly triggering and very... emotional to read. I've kind of had to dose it to myself slowly as I want to go through it, because a lot of the experiences that the students are putting out there are just incredibly familiar to me, having gone to an elite boarding school for high school and to incredibly white university for college. It just was so much stuff where just even walking around and being black in those environments is so... damaging, and in ways you don't even realize until you're out of it and you're like, whoa, that wasn't cool, that wasn't right, and you accept it as the norm because it is just what you're kind of having to deal with. So definitely check both of those hashtags out. So that's Black UVA Demands and not just UVA. But let's turn to our guests.
Yeah, happier things.
Let's talk about you. That's what we really want to do. So, as you mentioned, you do have you are a mom. So, talk a little bit about your family and a little about your background. So we know a little more about you.
All right. Yeah. So I was raised in Seattle, which is, if you guys don't know this, it's one of the whitest major cities in the country, and. Raised by a white mom, my dad, Nigerian, but he lived and died in Nigeria. My brother and I are, a year and a half apart, grew up together. We were always like the only black kids anywhere, but we are very visibly black, especially for having a white mother. And we always kind of stood out, we're kind of outcast, weird kids. But we love Seattle. We do. We love Seattle. It's like an abusive relationship. We keep coming back, and, Seattle does not treat us right, but we love Seattle. And I have two kids. I'm a single mom. I've been a single mom most of my life. I had my oldest son, when I was 20, and he went to college with me. He graduated from kindergarten the day before I graduated from college.
Oh, wow,
and he, my boys are everything, and they're hilarious and wonderful kids. So I have, a Sky degree in political science. I write about race. I write about gender. I write about parenthood. Just living out here, and when you live in a society like this, and you live in a city that's so white, and the amazing brown people here in Seattle are spread far, between the internet and your words and how you communicate with people is how you survive. with any sort of sense of self in an environment like this. So that's what I do, and it's just been taking off, and people have been wanting to hear what I have to say, and we've been having some great conversations, and it's been amazing.
Yeah, I mean, your work has just been awesome just to read, and it's been such a wonderful mix of humor and realness, because sometimes it's hard to strike that balance. I just find all of your pieces are able to really get that dead on, where, you know, you're coming with the truth, but as a person of color that's reading it, I get the humor, and it's so enjoyable as well. So I know you had a recent job change. So talk a little bit about that, and kind of what, you know, how that was, stepping off that precipice and stepping into your full-time writing career.
Oh, man. Okay. So, like, I was actually just talking about this. You know, I am a Black feminist in Seattle, and I have worked for, like, the last 6 years. My day job has been in advertising for the auto industry. Oof. And I don't know if you guys know what the auto industry is like.
Very much.
But it's like if you took any semblance of class out of Mad Men, that's the day-to-day life of the auto industry, right? It's like the same guys, like the sexist jokes trying to sleep with you and the racism, but, you know, it's stale cigarettes and the furniture is shitty. You know, like, it's that's pretty much the environment.
Did you work for an agency or one of the big auto makers?
One of the big auto companies. So I'd done that for years. I was really good at it, paid the bills. But as the writing picks up, and the more that you live in your values and live in your ideals, the more this writing are the things I believe in, you know, the less able I was able to go into an office where, you know, jokes would be about the women you slept with, or, you know, what these weird brown people did, you know. And it was really fun here, because I was thinking, you know what, like, I can just, maybe I'll try it. Maybe one of these days I'll try it. And I was having a really bad day. And I was saying, you know what, like, I feel like I just need to leave, and it sounds like this is so toxic. And then I got this email from my boss, and it was just a horrible email. And I replied back, like, okay, cool, I'll take care of it. Also, I quit. And that was it. And I was just like, I'm done, and I'm going to give this a try. And I had some mortgage money saved, and we'll see how it goes. So it's weird, like, to live the thing that's just been my passion, you know, on the side for a while and see what can come of it. I still am skeptical. It's all been so fast, you know, as to how it goes. I still wake up every day going, I can't believe people want to hear what I have to say. Like, it's really surreal to me, but it's a lot of fun, and I'm putting all I can into it.
And I, you know what, I'll just say, as a big, big fan of your writing, and there's a few things. I think few writers successfully cross-platform and cross-medium as successfully as you do. So your tweets are a form of writing. You're on, you know, you storify them. You do a lot of, you write in very many ways. I think it's terrific. But the more, like you said, that you're in your true, you know, your true voice and spirit, and like kind of what you're meant to do. Like, I don't know if you feel like that, but that seemed like a real aha moment. We're like, man, this day is really getting bad. Oh, it's getting worse. Holy cow, my boss just sent me an email. I'm out. And yeah. Like, but, you know, so however you came to it, but you're living, what's Oprah say? Like, you know, when you're meant to do what you're meant to do, it's really a special kind of thing. I feel like we saw that. I feel like we've watched that. And that's kind of what I jokingly said, like, I feel like we discovered and I own some ownership. Like, I don't really mean that at all, but I've really enjoyed, you know, before, I think we started, I guess, when was the white girl storify? Was that right before you quit or right after you quit?
A couple months before I quit. Yeah. Well, I mean, I just quit. I'm actually really new to all of this, and I feel like everyone's response has kind of felt like that. And it's been wonderful, because I've always been really safe. You know, I've got two kids, right? Making, you know, solid financial decisions. And it felt like once I started writing and things started picking up, everyone was saying, do this. Just do this. You're good at this.
For sure.
And, you know, it's been wonderful. Like, your support, everyone's support has meant, I mean, it really has been instrumental in me getting some of the confidence to feel like, okay, you know what, there may be something here. I can do this. It's meant a lot.
Well, I was like, literally, when you tweeted, like, you know, my boss sent me this email, I quit. I was like, Drew, she quit. I was like all excited. It was just really funny because also there's a part of it where you're really opening yourself up also to people listening to you and knowing more about you. And, you know, the writing you do is very personal because you are writing about feminist issues and you're writing about race. So it's a lot of stuff that comes from the heart. And with that, being a Black woman in that space is unique. I'm sure you've already noticed it. I wanted to talk about the Kimmy Schmidt piece just for a second because, I loved your piece on it and I loved, you know, just your take. And I thought it was a very, obviously well written, but also, you know, good vision on why you felt the way that you felt about it and your hopes for the show itself and why it let you down. But the backlash, I mean, really?
Yeah, it's probably the most backlash I've ever gotten, which is hilarious because it's a TV show. But
yeah.
People were coming out. You thought I called the lady ugly. Like, they were coming out from everywhere.
And that was
people
more.
People were sounding the duels all over Twitter.
That was more backlash than what was the. And you were talking about as a writer. Was it a piece in The Guardian that some people mistook?
Yeah. It was more backlash than that, even.
Wow.
And that was hard because that one actually felt like cogent, you know,
like, based in some reality.
Yeah, because I think here's the difference is that it seemed like a lot of the people that took offense at this, like, they took it personally for some reason.
Yeah, like, TV show though.
Don't you come after Tina Fey? Like, I don't know what the problem was. It was just crazy. But I see this a lot with women of color that are in the space when they're writing that our opinions in and of themselves is something to be attacked. And no other group gets that scrutiny except for women of color. Even men of color, they don't get this scrutiny of you don't even get to have an opinion. Their opinion's
exactly.
Allowed. People will disagree with them, but it won't be like you don't get to have an opinion. And this is what the critique was of this piece. The one that got me was the one person that said, this writer just seems like she's trying to be offended. What the hell does that even mean?
That's such a horrible hobby to have, by the way. Like, that's not fun. Like, to be offended.
I don't think people pay for that. That's not high on the.
It's just crazy. Have you seen it in terms of like getting your assignments and stuff or anything like that, and you know, kind of getting your opinion out there, or have things been pretty easy in the assignment side of things, not necessarily in the backlash after it's out there.
You know, the assignments are funny because what often happens when I get assignments, especially when it comes to race, are someone thought this was an interesting topic. Mm. Would you like to write about it? And what that means, right, is a white person wants to know more about this but doesn't feel qualified to write on it.
I think you're giving that too much credit. What that really means is four white dudes in a boardroom already had this discussion and they need a Black woman to write it.
Or what that really means is they saw like somebody's tweet about something. Yeah. They're like, we need to write about that too.
Twitter was talking about this and I don't know what it means. Please write about it.
Oh my God.
That's got to be the. Go ahead.
It's interesting because, you know, I know what I'm getting into with one of those pieces. It's never really been a problem as far as tone. In fact, sometimes I often think, like, there are times where I catch myself saying, oh man, you know, this poor white guy's going to be reading this. And should I edit this so that it's easier for him to read? And I'm like, no. But what ends up happening sometimes is, you know, I can tell when a piece I've written has been heavily edited by a white person. And when it hits too close to home for them. You know, they want an edgy piece. They get a piece full of truth, and then they can't handle the truth, and they kind of chip away at it.
And let me ask you, I don't know the writing industry well enough. Do you get like? So I'm asking you to do something. You write it, and I, as an editor, I get to like pick it apart and reword it. Like, where do you get as the author to say, you know what, this is no longer mine? Like, what leverage do you have, if any?
Yeah, that becomes tricky, and I think a lot of people don't realize a couple of things. Like nowadays, for almost anything you write that goes to publication, you don't write the byline.
Huh.
And so that's something where editors can really change their tone. They come up with the byline. So I started writing one no matter what, just to kind of plant a suggestion into the brains of the editors of like, hey, you know, because they will change it to get as many eyes looking at it as possible.
Sure,
right.
Clickbait set the tone.
And you're like, this byline is horribly offensive. This is a horrible byline. That's why. The person that wrote the article didn't write that, by the way.
Right.
Interesting.
The person wanting people to click on it wrote it.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. And they go through, you know, reputable people will go through and edit and have you look at it at least before they publish it. But a lot of people, they just tweak it and publish it and run it. And the tone is completely changed. They cut, you know, so much, and you look through it and you're just, you're almost trying to pick your battles of what, you know, the least violating change they made that you can reach out to them. And what sucks too is if you don't catch it on the first pass, once it's out there, the only way you can change it is to publish a retraction.
Mm.
And that even brings more attention to the thing that you're trying to correct, you know, in the first place. So it becomes really tricky, and I'm just now learning to, like, really go over it all with a fine-tooth comb because I've been burned really bad by pieces that mean a lot to me. And now I only put pieces that I'm really sensitive about to editors that I trust to know my voice and know what I'm trying to say. And won't make a major change without reaching out to me. But a lot of editors just, they hack away. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't want to admit that, you know, because you want to be like, this is my piece. But the truth is so much gets changed between what you write and what you send. There have been times where, you know, people reached out to me and I've sent them the originals. And they're like, this doesn't even sound like the same thing. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, that's what happens.
Absolutely. And I imagine, like everything else, you know, with supremacy in all institutions and processes, that it's even worse for people of color and, of course, women of color. So
misogynoir,
I can only
sure.
imagine the narrative that tries to be swept away. So, Drew, I think you found something.
Well, before we get to the piece on, is it Matter? Is that a publication?
Yes.
So
six
snazzy new ways to be totally racist without that horrid racist smell. That's not your byline, or did you use that byline?
So that's not my byline, but this editor is awesome, and he actually checked with me.
That's a good byline.
That's a good byline. I'd click on that. Six snazzy new ways to be totally racist without that.
Yeah, I like that. And he kind of took it from my words, and he was like, how does this sound? And that's the way it should go, you know? And I'm like, hey, I've been thinking about this. How does this sound?
Interesting.
And he was absolutely respectful of the tone of the piece, you know, and that was wonderful.
So
I appreciate that.
We have a writer who's prolific at Twitter. I mean, really, like, you want to know, like, I've tweeted at least twice, like, you just won Twitter, like, the trolling the MLK Day racist kid, like, the women thing, like, you've tweeted some epic stuff. But so, we saw on The Daily Show, on CNN, on, like, three or four different channels on the news, and they've been doing this more frequently, where instead of reporting on something, they'll take a tweet, and they'll, you know, credit the tweet. They'll say this is it. And this most recent one was Reign of April, and it was about Starbucks, which we'll get to. And she made the comment like, "Oh, great! You know, you're going to explain 400 years of you know, supremacy and racism in, you know, so many minutes over a cup of coffee. Like, you know, no thanks," or something like that. But they all had it on their shows. And I saw a series of tweets between Feminista Jones and The Trudes, and they're both writers. The Trudes, I think, writes for Gradient Layer, and they were talking about specifically people not retweeting their tweets, but quote tweeting it and changing it to sort of fit their narrative, and then maybe tagging them. And it's frequently, almost always, white men and women that do this. So I guess my comment to you is, what's your thought about, you know, tweeting and retweeting and people that, you know, edit or do your tweets? Or if someone were to use a tweet as their story, does that really benefit you in any way? Is that good exposure for you? Like, how do you feel about that? That's a pretty common practice now.
You know, I'm kind of mixed feelings about this because I'm not even under the illusion that Twitter hasn't been completely instrumental to my career as a writer, right? I mean, if it weren't for Twitter, most everybody would not know who I am. That's where I kind of got my start, was in this weird platform where you have to really make things concise and boil it down. But at the same time, what ends up happening is people a lot of times do take pieces of what you write. You'll find certain publications follow your tweets all the time and just look for things they can pull out and use. I am okay with being retweeted. I'm okay with my tweets showing up places. As long as there's attribution. I've only had once where a tweet I used was completely kind of twisted. And actually, it was about the Starbucks. Reframed. And it was really weird because, you know, the tweet was used in an article. It was attributed to someone else completely. And kind of used in a weird way. And I was like, hey, you know, this was a publication I'd always dreamed of appearing in, and it was weird to see my words in there. get used differently, and, you know, being portrayed as a different person. Like, they put me in there as a Starbucks employee, and I'm like, I'm not a Starbucks employee. You know, it was just a really strange thing. And when that happens, I get why people are upset. And I think part of, I think what people need to understand, I think, you know, maybe, and I'm not speaking for Feminisha Jones, but as a woman of color to rights and rights primarily online, I see this a lot, is that it's not just Twitter, right? The internet is constantly taking the work of people of color and trying to take it for free and soak up those ad dollars. Every single week, probably every 3 days, I get an email from a major publication asking if they can republish something I've already written that's proven to be successful for free. And they say that it's exposure, right? But they're doing it because they know it's successful. If I have a blog post on my personal blog that has 500,000 views in 2 weeks, and they say they want to give me exposure and republishing it for free, what they're really saying is we want those ad dollars and we don't want to share it with you.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, when you get to the point where even your everyday conversations on Twitter are being taken and that writer is getting paid to take your words, I get why that frustration gets there. It's not just about Twitter. It's the entire industry that's run by, like, old white dudes who want to keep all that capital but still want to cash in on the people out there on the front lines who really get what's going on. And that's the writers of color that are out there on the internet today.
And who is it? Was it there's a couple different people that tried to do things for free claiming exposure. And one was a big event. It was Lena Dunham, and she ended up canceling it, where she was going to have all these artists perform as a showcase in front. And one of the artists, like, wrote a letter. It was open on the internet. It was like, you know, dear Lena, like, no thanks. Like, you know, you're not going to pay me? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. Even it happened during Oprah's, like, Live Your Best Life
tour
or whatever, where she was asking local artists to be there for the exposure.
It's same, like, deal.
You're charging people hundreds of dollars per person to come to this thing, and you don't have money to pay me? Like, what are you talking about right now?
Do either of you know the and I don't know the exact person, but there's somebody who's suing over a libelous fake retweet. So there was, like, I don't know who it is. I guess a R&B singer, rapper, somebody. And then a fake account retweeted, like, made it look like a retweet, but it wasn't really a retweet. Like, he just put RT in capitals and quote this and that and put in then, like, you know, I don't know who it was. Was it Lil Wayne? Somebody put in someone's name and then had some, like, ridiculous tweet that got retweeted thousands of times and people were commenting on it. And now they're, like, I think they're suing. Do you know who that is, Ijoma? I don't know who that is.
Was that the, like, white people one?
I think it was.
I know. It's really vague, right? Because, like, I think I know what you're talking about, and I can't remember his name. It was a dude, and, like, he left Twitter because of it.
Yeah, who is it? Let me search on Twitter.
Yeah, I don't remember. I didn't know about that one. But, yeah, I definitely, I mean, it's a unique thing. I think it's been great to have Storify as a new way to use your own tweets too, which has kind of taken away a little bit of the power from these aggregators who decide to put up a quote unquote article, and it's literally nothing but tweets from people that they've put together. So I love that, and I love the way you use Storify. So that's always great to be able to hear the full story and see it. So we were poking around your website, and I think Drew noticed that you had
some goals
that you were working on up there.
Oh my God. Yes. So we forgot about those.
We thought we just, you know, randomly right on the spot here, just go through and see how things are going.
Okay.
When did you write the goals? How long ago did you write the goals?
A while ago. But this was a major goal project that my friends and I had to, like, get through a list of, like, 100, no, it was like 300 goals, but it was a lot.
Nice.
Okay.
All right. So the first one said, strike up a conversation with a stranger at least once a week.
Yeah, that's the internet has completely solved that for me. I have conversations with more strangers than I. This was before Twitter.
I was going to say, you probably talk to a stranger every day now. That's got to be like every hour or something. Okay. So another one was go to a live performance at least once a month.
Yes, I have done pretty good on that. I mean, my brother is a musician and a comedian and performer all around. So I've been pretty good at that. Lately, I haven't wanted to leave my house, like, the last couple of months. I've been really soaking up this whole, like, writing, staying at home, not putting on pants life, but, you know.
That's always a good thing. I saw that you had written that the more high profile the assignment is, the more you leave it up to the last minute the other day. And I was laughing my head off because I've done a bunch of speeches and I had to make like the biggest one I had to make. It was in front of like 7,000 people. And I was like, I literally put it up till 2 a.m. like two nights before I had to make the speech. But I wasn't inspired to do it till then.
You crushed it though.
What was I going to do? You have to wait to be, you know, ready to do it.
I think like the most, you know, I think the way you can guarantee that A, I'm going to like do a kind of shitty job, and B, that I will hate doing it, is to say, we'll pay you a lot of money for this. Like, I don't know why, but it's in that way. You know, this is really important. Or we'll pay you a lot of money, guarantee you that dread will immediately fill my body anytime I think of that project. You know,
too funny. Hilarious. So the next one, I feel like it's a little, probably a little easier where you live. Like, go outside.
It's all raining.
But it says for at least 30 minutes every sunny day. So that's probably not true.
It's like 12 days. It's like 12 days. That's a weak goal. I'm not trying to shade, but no shade. In Seattle? Come on. If it was like Southern California, I'd be like, wow, that's a lot. It's like 300 days a year.
And I also feel like in Seattle,
like, a couple of reasons that gives us credit. Okay, first off, I wrote that goal before I went natural. Okay, so if you have your last hair, you understand that going outside every day when you live in Seattle is a ridiculous proposition. If you ever want to look halfway decent,
touche, fairly noted. And I was just saying how rainy and wet it is, and if you had relaxed hair, I totally understand.
Yeah, and now I'm natural. Like, I don't care. I'm kind of immune to the elements, right? Like, my hair just, it is what it is. But back then, you know, I had a patch that I had to keep up.
You had to worry about it. Sure.
You know, that mattered. That was like an hour of, you know, blow drying and straightening.
When'd you do the big chop? Yeah.
I did. And then I freaked out. I'm actually kind of sad because, you know, hair is important in the Black community. Mm. And hair is important to women, especially if you are a bigger woman, right? Like, you need to have more hair. Like, there's that weird law of, like, oh, it'll offset. People won't notice you got a fat ass, you got fat hair. Like, it's a weird thing.
It's an offset.
Yeah, and it's not true, right? Like, I've never looked at someone and said, oh my God, their head is so small compared to their ass, right? Like, it's not a thing that happens. But I cut my hair, and I freaked out and was like, no, everyone's looking at my face. This is the worst thing that ever happened to me. And I, like, hid my hair under wigs and stuff for, like, a year. And then it grew out. And then I was like, oh, seeing all these pictures of people with beautiful, short, curly hair. And I was like, oh, maybe I missed it. Like, I missed that whole thing. So then I cut it again and, like, cut the sides off. And now I've got, like, this mohawk thing.
I love your hair. And another podcast that we listened to recently.
Say that again.
Karen, shout out to you, Karen, just chopped her hair off, and I am completely envious. I'm like threatening. I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to do it. I'm going to just chop it off. Maybe in the summer I'll do it.
I miss
the short hair.
I previously kind of felt like, no, you can't chop your hair off
again.
I was anti-chopping. Well, you know.
For the second time.
Yeah. I was all for the first time. I've actually... from day one, preferred your hair curly and natural. But anyway, if you wanted to chop it now, I think I have had enough hands in hair time. I've had enough touching of hair.
You're ready?
Yeah. I mean, I love the TWA too. I like the way that feels.
Yeah. Plus, it's much easier, especially in the summertime. It's like just
dough. Hey, co-wash day is like a 4-hour.
Oh God.
Wash day is a
trial.
I've got my wash day down, man. Mine is quick. Like, I'm like 20 minutes in and out. Like, I've got my hair trained. I've got a system. It's awesome.
Maybe you could teach Leslie.
Yeah, maybe I need to quell mine down a bit. Oh my gosh. So another goal you had was to take a picture of the kids at least once a week.
Yes. And I have done pretty good at that. And I'm glad I did because now that they have like time hop.
Yeah.
Right? Like, now I'm like reaping like the benefits of taking all those pictures on my phone because you forget what your kids look like. Like, you forget they grow so fast. Their faces change. All their features change. And now, you know, all that stuff that you think is frivolous that you were just putting on the internet comes back on this app, and you see 4 years ago that your kid, you know, I remember when my kid gave himself a ridiculous haircut. I don't remember what that looks like, but when it pops up and I can see 4 years ago today, my son chopped all his hair off, you know, in random places. And you get to laugh and, you know, remember what that was like. So I'm really glad that I did that and I have those pictures there. And all those things people thought were frivolous, like, I don't want to see people to see your kids all the time. Well, I want to see them.
Yeah.
And now they pop up as, you know, after a teenager and he's stinky and gross. Love him to death. But, you know, it's something to remember when he didn't smell so bad. And, you know, I could pick him up.
Teenage boys do
so
smell
bad. So, Ijeoma, you're four now for four.
No, hold on a second. Goals. I have a question. Now, is your oldest on Twitter?
You know... I think he just posted because I had the worst day yesterday, like 2 days ago. Like, it was a horrible day. And the icing on the cake was that my son joined Twitter. And ooh. I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
It's my space.
Yeah, honestly, that might be one of those, like, the hashtag, like, four words you never want to hear. What's your Twitter handle, Mom?
No, no.
I know.
What's your handle, Mom? No.
It's too funny. So
four out of four. This four last four. One, that I have... If she hits this one, I'll be really impressed.
I'm already impressed, but okay, here we go. So read all of the books in your library.
No, nowhere near. In fact, I've probably added way more books that I haven't read to said library.
And you still buy physical books?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I've got physical books. I have a ton of books. You know, I'm one of those people where it's like, oh, that looks interesting. And I went to the bookstore in high school. And I just buy it, right? And anytime anybody mentions a new book, I pick it up and buy it. But then I am also kind of old, and I fall asleep the moment I start reading. So I buy a book, and I'm like, I'm going to read this. And then 2 minutes later, I'm snoring, and it's all over. So, yeah.
All right. I've been having this problem of I buy these really amazing, especially nonfiction books about race and race relations and historical, and then, like, they piss me off while I'm trying to read to go to sleep. And I'm like, nope, this is not a bedtime book because it just got me so incensed right now reading that chapter was not a good chapter to try and get myself to bed. Speaking of bad chapters.
Are you talking about Starbucks now?
Yeah, let's have a little chat about race.
Let's race together.
Is it race
Ijeoma?
Together? Oh, my gosh.
Let's race together.
I just, everything about this entire situation has been one giant lesson in privilege to me because from the idea of it to their reaction to people's well-deserved criticism of it to them pulling the plug. And of course, in the midst of all that, Black people who have been forced to take a stance and say, hey, this isn't cool. We're the ones that are attacking. Like, really? You made us have to tell you why this is so fucked up. And now we're the bad guys.
Yep.
Good job.
And this is, you know what makes me mad? And I said this so many times. Racism affects people of color, but it is a white people problem. And this constant desire to push it on people of color, to relive what they're already suffering through at the hands of other people in order to feel better and feel like you're making progress is wrong and it's exploitation. And it's so frustrating, once again, to be like, oh, we need to just have a better conversation about it. No. You know what? White people, sit in a room. Figure this shit out. Stop being racist. Stop profiting off of the exploitation of people of color and maybe cool. Like, don't make somebody making $7 an hour educate you on the system that you're currently getting rich off of. It's just, it makes me so mad. It hit me at a time where I was getting so much, like, demands to explain racism to white people. And it just felt like, how exploitative to expect that of your 40% minority staff that makes shit pay, you know, to take on this role so that you can feel good about yourself and your $1,300 an hour that you make as CEO of this company, you know?
And... white people.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you, Zoe. No, for sure. And, you know, it also is just the situation of not just pushing it on people to talk about this race, but I say all the time that one of the biggest impediments to Black liberation are progressives and liberals because their desire to feel good always trumps their desire to do good. And it's a really huge, you know, I always say it's an elephant in the room because, like, I'm not racist. I'm a liberal person. I marched in the 60s. Yeah. I, you know, source my coffee from ethical places and all of this bullshit. And it's like, what are you talking about? We're trying to talk about systemic racism that benefits you and makes me feel bad on a regular basis. That's what this conversation is about. So stop trying to talk about yourself. And then the other part that just is baffling to me is that a corporation cannot start a moral conversation.
Yeah. It's no, like, this is wrong. Like, first off, this is like not what you signed. Unless someone in Starbucks contract, they're like, also, we may at times call upon you to, you know, give moral guidance on race relations in America. It's just an HR violation. Like, that's just not okay. Like, in no way do I want corporations that have, you know, put small businesses out of business left and right across the country responsible for anything to do with the, you know, moral fabric of this country.
No, and they've had so many issues like that with their baristas wanting to unionize, with, as you mentioned, they are certainly a harbinger of horrifying and devastating gentrification in communities of color. Their sourcing of their own products is questionable in third world countries. So it's like, where do you get off coming to the table to try and think you are the ones to start some sort of moral conversation? I am going to read Reign of April's tweet, the one that was, and I will say it was on the Nightly Show. It was on last week with
Larry Elders,
John Oliver. No, Nightly Show's the Larry one. And also it was on CBS this morning. Gayle King read it out loud. And what she said was, not sure what Starbucks was thinking. I don't have time to explain 400 years of oppression to you and still make my train. Hashtag race together. Now, it's a perfect tweet, and I totally get why they like chose it, because it's very succinct and it completely gets across everything that needed to be said. Like, yeah, if I'm in your building, I'm not trying to talk to any of you about race together, but I've heard so many like awesome suggestions of what people wanted to do. Some people were like, well, I'm going to go with my own Sharpie and just start like writing racist stuff on there, like hashtag Mike Brown. What do you think about that? And give it back to them. And then other people said they were going to give really inappropriate names for them to write on the cups and then have them have to say that out loud. But the thing that also got me is I think Starbucks has like a 78% to 80% white customer base, and about 48% of their employees are people of color. So, I mean, look at the situation, even statistically, how stupid it is for you to say, oh, all these white people are going to come in here, and I'm going to make this situation that's already puts these the white customer in the power position. Just they're the customer, so they're going to be right. And now you're making these people of color have to engage with them about race relations. Yeah. It's just the craziest thing I've ever heard of. And then we have Common. Drew, you have a video.
Oh,
yeah?
God.
Let's
oh,
play
my
that
God.
Right
Call
quick.
Me.
I never thought I would be able to stand in front of a company, shareholders, and say that you care.
It's like
I always believed that people in power didn't care.
They don't.
People, I would say, why do companies make all this money and don't care for the communities that are supporting them? Well, I'm here to witness that Starbucks is a different type of company.
That was him at the shareholders meeting when they're announcing the event.
How much money do you think they pay him?
Can I just say, this is the danger of pumpkin spice, people, okay? This is what pumpkin spice does to you. Suddenly, your head turns all orange, like common turn. You start wearing turtlenecks all the time, and you start talking black, right? Like, stay away from pumpkin spice, brown people.
It
because
is the devil.
It will turn you into some weird-ass, new black, nonsense-talking person. It's a horrible thing. That's all I have to say.
Charles Barkley's been drinking pumpkin spice for a long time.
Exactly.
Ben Carson swims in it.
Turn into a pumpkin. This is what happens.
It's true.
Don't do it.
Pumpkin spice latte.
I just don't even know what to say. Everything about that's like why do people in power not care? They don't care. So, as evidenced by you being on that stage right now.
And that's a good segue, and I like to wear my egg on my face, and I'm comfortable with it. And I imagine a lot of probably white people were thinking, you know, the same way I was. And I was very aware of all the problems we just discussed. And I still, despite all that, I said, you know, on the one hand, I was thinking, you know, man, they really fucked it up. They punted it terribly. They, you know, was abusive to their employees. It's kind of ridiculous, but they did something. Like, it's not that, like, I was like, think it was a good thing, but like, I always talk about on Twitter and my White Privilege podcast, you know, as a white person in this space, we're going to fuck up like repeatedly. And that's just our lot in life. Like, fuck up, fall down, try harder, you know, vow never to make that mistake again and keep moving forward. Like, that's just, it's going to happen. And I was thinking of this on a macro scale, like, wow, they fucked up. Maybe they could, you know, retool and try something different. And I really, you know, it wasn't like heated, but you know, got checked by Leslie. And some of the stuff she said, she's already kind of reiterated, like, first of all, who's a corporation has a moral compass to do this? But it's, you know, the crux of it was, you know, any organization that seeks to do this outwardly, whether it be a, you know, a corporation, whether it be Amnesty International, whoever wants to do this work, they've really got to start internally. And I accept and understand that because that's how I am. I, you know, if I'm going to, you know, have any sort of, I don't know what, like, activity as a person in social justice, I know I'm going to fuck up, but I have to really work on my privilege and make sure I don't fuck up and, you know, understand, educate myself, do all the things necessary so that I don't fuck up, because I don't want to fuck up. Like, that's my lot, knowing I'm going to fuck up, but I really work hard not to. And that's the crux of it, is that, like, did Starbucks really try? Like, did they really try at all? Like,
but they didn't.
That was your point. And I'm saying, I think I agreed with you then, and I'm saying now that, you know, I'm sure there are other white people listening that, you know, yeah, they tried something, you know, but did they really try? Like, there's a lot of indications that they didn't try. Like, not at all.
Yeah. Well, and I think one thing, too, that I think we need to talk about, when we talk about, like, racial justice, or when we talk about oppression in general, we need to stop looking at intention. Intention doesn't mean shit. Yep. Intention doesn't oppress me. Actions oppress me. And as long as you can say, oh, they meant well, oh, they tried, it doesn't matter. And in fact, I don't even take it to a personal judgment on that person, because who that person is means nothing to me. Who they are as a person means nothing to me. And if they are oppressing me, it doesn't actually mean that I think they're a human being. I don't care what type of a human being they are. What I care about is how their actions affect me. And I think that dialogue built around what people are trying and what people's intentions are is deliberate to get us to stop looking at the actual day-to-day consequences of the little things we do that uphold this entire system. And we need to cut that completely out of the equation and stop looking at intentions, stop looking at people. Meanwhile, I don't care if you're doing it for the money. I don't care what you're doing it. I don't care if you're looking at me and you hate everything about me, so long as you're not using that.
Yeah.
To affect my day-to-day life. And I think we need to cut that out of the discussion, because when we have all these quote-unquote well-meaning steps towards, you know, fixing something that are half-assed, that are more harm than good, that reinforce a system that puts the onus on people of color to fix a problem within the white community, you know, we're not going to get anywhere. And it's just a scapegoat to say, oh, look, you know, I tried and these brown people got so mad at me. No.
You know, I had to delete my Twitter account.
You've heard a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that their response to the criticism is what shows you that they didn't even have any intent.
There was no genuine.
There wasn't even a genuine intent. And that's where I really even, this particular thing particularly pissed me off because of that fact. Yeah. They don't even have the intent to fall back on. It's a bullshit excuse anyways, but they don't even have that to fall back on. I think I did an analogy for you, Drew. I said, that's like me saying that I'm going to try and run a marathon, but I'm only willing to purchase new sneakers. And then you say to me, hey, but you need to train. And I throw the sneakers at your head. That's basically what they did. They didn't try anything, and it didn't matter, because the end result is you got hit in the head with something, and I'm not at all equipped to run a marathon. So that's pretty much what they came to the table.
And I fully support the outcome, not intent. And in this instance, the only outcome was really fucked up shit for people of color. Like, it was abusive. Yeah. It was literally abusive to their people of color employees. It was, you know. And I was thinking, like, intent, like, what was the intent? It must sounds like a giant PR move. You know, I don't know what they're trying to do, but they failed in every way, miserable. And the global VP of communications couldn't take the heat on Twitter and deleted his account. I just, I don't know if that.
Not just deleted his account, said that people of color attacking him. And it's like, you don't even know the word attack. If I could show you the number of times someone calls me the N-word on a daily basis, those are attacks. Somebody giving you actual criticism about some bullshit that you put out, that's not an attack. People of color criticizing you is not an attack. And like white people need to just wake the fuck up on that line of thought. It's just like this white genocide business. You're using words that you don't understand the meaning of and applying them totally incorrectly. That's not an attack.
I got one more in.
White people.
Yes, exactly. So turning to some more troubling, celebrity discussions. Let's hear some words from one Raven Simone real quick. No. Let's see what she has to say.
You're not afraid to back away from comments either. Okay, so let's talk about The View, girl. Did you expect it to blow up the way it did?
Which blow up?
The one I had to apologize for,
the one that I'm not saying nothing about.
Okay, let's
not just playing. Tell me what you want.
The Michelle Obama, you know, you kind of somewhat, I guess, defending the presenter that was.
I don't know if I was defending.
I don't know. That's what I was asking.
I don't think I was defending. I think that, you know, he got fired, mm-hmm. and for a reason, it was very distasteful, mm-hmm. what he said. It was very distasteful. And I don't believe she looks like one at all. I don't believe she should have been casted. But I do know that a lot of people I know have animal traits. I don't know who says that they've never said, hey, that person looks like, I look like a bird.
What do I look like?
I think you look like a Bambi. I think you look like Bambi.
Thank you.
You do. She looks like a little deer.
Oh, I'm pausing it there.
Yeah, please.
I mean, really? I don't even know. What?
Okay, there was a thing, though. I have been giving her a lot of shit, right? Because she has been saying some problematic stuff. But what I realized is that interview, if you listen to the whole thing, we need to lay off of her because she's not a smart person. Like, there's something, you know, life in showbiz, nobody educated her. Because did you hear after that how she said she went to Ancestry.com?
Yeah, and she's
and found out that she is from every continent on Africa except for one. What? What? Yeah. Every continent on Africa. Mm-hmm. Except for one.
Yeah, I like when she said, which blow up?
Yeah.
So like,
the one where you said you weren't black?
What continent is she talking about? The continent in Africa?
Yeah.
Or... Oh, the other continents of Africa. Like, this woman just doesn't know anything. And, you know, between her and Carmen and all of this stuff, I just wonder, how much money does it take before you become New Black? Like, what? At what point?
When does it happen? I don't know when it actually happens. The thing about Raven, though, that I find interesting is she has handlers. She has a publicist. She has a manager. Yeah. You know, she has people that are around her to decide what she's going to do. Not necessarily what she's going to say, but certainly what she's going to be doing. And she's been in this business for a long time. So she understands the media. My thing about her is, and she may not be very smart, but at the same time, who the fuck was talking about Raven Simone before she claimed that she wasn't black on Oprah? Mm. Nobody was talking about her. And now every goddamn week, here she is saying something else fucking crazy. And we are talking about her again. So I have a sneaking suspicion.
She's exposure trolling us?
That she's been exposure trolling us. And I'm just going to say that right now, live for the first time on the Interracial John, because it's just too much. Like, now she's on Empire. Now she's going to be,
her curator.
The sister on Blackish coming up. It's a whole lot of you weren't doing anything since like whatever that Cheetah Girls thing was. And now all of a sudden she's everywhere and she's talking crazy every chance she can get.
I'm going to go with Ijoma that she was not edgy. I mean, she was like a 5-year-old, right? She was young on that show, 5 to like 8 or 9, probably had, you know, quasi teachers on set. I'm not thinking that was the best education.
Well, I'm just saying Rudy got her degree. She went to Spelman. So what's Olivia's
Raven's excuse?
I
don't know.
Some of those kids, somehow, man.
You know, she could very well be like pulling us up. I actually think you can see like the wheels turning. Like you saw on The View before she started speaking, right? When she was looking at everyone talking and realized that she didn't have anything to contribute to the conversation. And then you could see her thinking, I'm just going to say something so that people know I'm talking. And then what came out was that complete ridiculousness about people looking like animals and how she looks like a bird. And like, you could see it though, because you could see her thinking like, oh man, you know, Rosie Perez is on point and she's saying stuff that makes sense. I'm the black person here, I have to say something. Here, people look like birds. You know, like, it was...
her first...
It probably made perfect fucking sense in her mind. She's like, I'm brilliant. I'm going to add some fucking dope-ass shit to this conversation right now.
Her first comment actually, to me, it confirmed to me she's definitely new black, because her first comment was, did he mean it like racist? That's a new black... That's got new black all over it. Did he mean it
like racist,
like
racist, or just kind of racist,
or just not really racist,
like hipster racist, or like, you know, really racist?
Calling the first lady a monkey is that could definitely not be racist somehow.
I mean, you know, monkeys are real; they exist. People like monkeys.
I'm gonna read that.
I mean, why is it gonna be about race?
I gotta go with Ijoma's very own writing. On her six snazzy ways to totally be racist without that horrid racist smell. Hey, you racist. No, not you with the Confederate flag sending out Obama is a monkey emails. You over there, closet racist. Time for a talk.
Absolutely.
You know, with the, and I didn't know this new black. That's a new kind of, it's an intra community dialogue that I wasn't familiar with.
Oh, but, that, did you just find out about it now, right now?
No, not right now. I haven't been using it, you know. It's not right now. This year. Okay. So I hadn't been, you know, using it, but when we had, we were talking about Barkley's comments, I said that there's some sort of like secret Illuminati, like American Express, like white card, and you can only get it by speaking this nonsense.
Charles Barkley's not new black. He's just dumb black. It's a whole different black.
Card. And I know this because I am a yellow skinned, mixed race black American, right? And there is nothing you can do that will actually make you black. You may think, make you white. You may think you have that white smell. You don't have that white smell.
Nope.
And you know, you may be allowed to like hang out for a while, but don't get confused.
Do you mean wet
like,
dog?
You're still the black person in the womb. I like being black. I don't even know why these people are like, yeah, I can finally buy my way out of blackness. I like blackness. It works for me. It's good.
Absolutely. So I did want to play the aftermath of that gentleman who went to a panel discussion, the topic of which was The Revolution Might Be Funny. Had awesome blogger, writer, and YouTube personality Francesca Ramsey, Harry Kondabula, Amir Rahman, and Jay Smoove, who had his own very awkward moment on live television last week. So they went to this person, the white person, actually went to this event and decided to spout off about the panelists being polarizing and how there's only, quote, one true race and how all other races are just, quote, mutations. As soon as he finished spewing his violent white supremacist bullshit, he put on a big ass fur coat and dramatically walked out of there.
So right there.
This is from Bapula Kapanir, and I'll put this link on the on the show notes as well, but let's just listen to Amir and Francesca's response to this idiot.
Wait, if you think about race being a construct, of course we know race is a construct. No one's here thinking there's absoluteness in this. Are you ready to go? Are you packing up? You said your piece, you're done? Oh, come on, man. Get the fuck out of here.
Now the fur coat goes on. Francesca's face.
Fucking fur coat.
You can start filming now. Well, it's really great that you didn't really have any interest in what we had to say. But, you know, white privilege in action, bro.
For real.
I mean, really.
Oh, that was amazing. One thing, too, though. The guy speaking, actually, that was Hurry.
Oh, Hurry. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. But, yeah. No, I wish, you know what, I wish white privilege normally came draped in a fur coat. Like, I think, if anything, if we could at least, if it could be that entertaining, I'd be a little more okay with it than... That was amazing.
And we have a visual,
like, he did that like 90 minutes into the thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, through that whole thing.
He sat through talking and answering other people's questions so he could ask his, and not even ask a question, just make his,
the
like,
statement.
Spew all of it. Now, this actually happened at the Amnesty International General Assembly that I was at this weekend, and it was a panel full of Ferguson protesters. Ms. Pat Gelly was there. Kayla Reed was there. Erica Totten from DC she was leading the panel. And this white guy got up from StopMassIncarceration.net, and he went on this diatribe about, you know, we need to be in the streets, and I went to Ferguson, and they arrested me, and they called me, even Antonio French called me an outside agitator, and I'm proud to be an outside agitator. We need to make everybody uncomfortable. We need to. And Kayla was like, sir, you don't get to tell black people what they need to do, and you don't get to tell us how we need to get free, and we'll do what needs to be done when it needs to be done. And then he continued to try and talk, and Y-Chef was like, sir, he wasn't even on the panel. He was just standing on the side. He was like, yeah, that's it, sir. You have to leave.
Tap him on the shoulder.
You have to go. That's my favorite part, though, is the white woman who was behind him. She got to the mic and she goes, well, That's not very comfortable to follow. And I was like, yeah. What you gonna do?
You know, white people, if you go start a fire, like, just be an arsonist and go start fires. But don't do it when we're the ones that are going to get clocked over the head and dragged off because you decided you wanted to come to our protest and burn shit down. So I think there's just a bunch of pyromaniacs out there. You want to break windows and burn down buildings, and they're thinking, hey, I'll do this in the name of good. And they're not, because they know they're not the ones who are going to get arrested for it. Like, I am so tired of white people. I can always tell when you're at a protest. You always know who's going to be trouble, right? Like, and it's always a weird group of, like, 20-something white people who are like, yeah, freak me, burn this shit to the ground. And you're like, oh, man, you're going to get me arrested. You're going to get me made.
Yeah, so true.
They can get better hobbies. They can just go, you know, they can just burn stuff down, right? They're probably not going to get, you know, nearly as much jail time as we would anyways. They can just do it on their own time.
You know,
and let us handle the rest.
I have to give you, I think that's the name of the episode, Leslie. If only white privilege came draped in a fur coat.
Yeah, that's definitely the name.
White privilege draped in a fur coat.
White privilege draped in a fur coat.
White privilege draped in a fur coat.
For sure.
I was going to say, though, the manifestations of it, if only it were that, you know, like.
I wish. The visual cue would be really fucking
not just
useful.
Visual, but so the same thing with, like, you can tell, like, the white person screaming F the police at the top of the lungs, like, dude, you're going to be a problem, right? I can tell that right away.
Yeah.
But it's the more subtle ones. Like, we had a march here. The thing Leslie was talking about, speaking in front of 7,000 people. And it's a big action. There's, you know, 7,000 people there. And this one group of white women were just so dead set on shaving their head as a form of solidarity on, like, the main stage and in front of everybody in the crowd. And it was going to be this big thing. And we spent all this time talking about two white women shaving their head. And the one woman had shaved her head like 2 weeks ago. Like, I'm not even kidding.
I'm not even kidding.
With all like seriousness and no irony, they didn't even bother them or occur to them that, like, we just, you know, like 30% of our time is talking about you two women shaving your head.
And my whole thing was, it was so clear that, like, she felt so good after she shaved her hair the first time that she just was determined to have that feeling again. And I wanted to tell her, it's kind of like heroin, ma'am. You're not going to have the same feeling. You're going to be chasing that high for the rest of your goddamn life. So just stop now. Please just stop now. So I want to switch gears a little bit. And again, as we said, anytime you have to go, just let us know. But the one thing I for sure want to make sure we talked about with you is, you know, I would say it's your superpower if I had to give you one. And that would be dealing with trolls.
Yeah, she's got, like,
I mean, if it's not a superpower, you for sure have your PhD, because it's, you know, beyond your varied, effective, and incredibly hilarious interactions with these fucking nut jobs that think they're so smart.
Did you read that there now is, I guess, empirical evidence suggesting that ignoring trolls is not the right move, that attacking back is the right move. Have you seen that report?
I saw that report, but the thing about it is I agree to an extent, and this is why our guest is such a master, because it can't just be attacking for attacking's sake. It has to be pointed at them so that the absurdity of them as a troll is so exposed.
Mm.
And that's the masterful part of what you do and have done to so many people. It beyond tickles me, because it's like, oh my God, this troll just got served so hard. And all you had to do was just be so much smarter than they are. And you already are that. So it was just, it's just the best. Well, so take me through I'll just start with the MLK Day one, because to me, that was the first one where I was like, oh, this is a whole other level of, you know, back trolling, as I like to refer to it. It was just magnificent. How did it form for you? And like, when did you first decide to send the first quote back to this idiot?
You know, I think part of it was, in all honesty, part of the reason why I decided to send that quote was because, you know, I know these trolls are out here doing all this hateful shit, trying to ruin a very important day to a lot of people. And it was working. Like, people were getting really hurt, you know, really violated, and people were tweeting about how awful it was to see all these racist tweets on MLK Day.
Mm.
And I realized, like, that's exactly, you know, what the goal is, right? If you already know what their goal is, and you know how to deny them that, and think that they're coming, so that, you know, they're wasting their time doing this, then, you know, and I just say, you know what, today especially, I'm going to put the exact opposite of what they're trying to do. They're trying to put hate into this space, trying to put anger into this space, and I'm just going to push love into this space. I'm just going to push these actual words that these people probably haven't even read about this man out there for them. And so I just started doing that. And this one too, just, you know, and it was funny because a couple of people that, you know, I replied to were just like, oh, it's just satire. Oh, sorry. Everyone backed down immediately. But this kid was, like, determined. And I was just going through the day. I was, like, at the grocery store, just tweeting phrases and, you know, going through, just keeping up the conversation. And then he, like, broke, you know, and it was just a strange thing to watch happening on a couple of different levels, like, as a black woman, as a person on the internet, and as a mom, to see this kid kind of break was really interesting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it seemed like, break is a perfect misnomer for it, because I feel like generally they're able to spew their hate in their own vacuum and not even care where it hits, because it never gets blown back on them in any real way. They don't care about what the other person thinks or says, and so it doesn't matter to them, which is why just attacking, you know, kind of back at them with the same vitriol doesn't work, because they don't care what you feel or how you react. They only care about themselves. So you have created a space where they're forced to think about themselves, and they're really stupid and shitty. And that's where the break happens. So the other one was my absolute favorite was, you know, white supremacists make shitty baristas.
And you know, I just, back to the MLK Day though, I want to give a real shout out for, like, repeatedly when I'm dealing with trolls, like, dude, this is just some fucking, like, pimple ass masturbating friggin' white idiot kid in his mom's basement. And, like, your troll kind of, like, was like I joke, he's like always some idiot, you know, like teenage kid in his mom's basement. Like, yep, he was.
Yeah, he was.
Yep.
So, yeah, white supremacists make shitty baristas. This one was particularly funny because you were so, you just wanted your coffee, man. And I just appreciated the commitment, really.
Yeah, it's like a brilliant comic that refuses to break character.
Yes, it reminds me of this thing that I've heard Tracy Morgan say about Will Ferrell. He says that Will Ferrell told him when he first joined Saturday Night Live that you have to be the straight man. He's like, it's always funnier when you play it straight. It's always funnier when you say the most absurd shit, but you don't act like it was absurd at all. You just act like you're saying exactly what needs to be said. And it's always more humorous that way. And this, all of your tweets were just like that. For me, I was reading them, I was howling with laughter because it just was so perfect. He's a deranged puppet. I mean, come on. It just was so, so great. And then how I noted, especially in your Storify, you included a few other people's tweets that came in. And so how has it been for you when people do start to kind of also join the conversation, especially if they're, for lack of a better phrase, on your side? And how do those interactions go? Do you subtweet to them as well, or is it really just you allow them to kind of participate and you interact with them that way?
You know, I think if they're just joining in the fun, I think it's fun because it can be cathartic, right? We all, you know, especially people in social justice, we all face trolls. We all see that hate. And it's fun to realize you can stop, you can laugh, and you can see it for the ridiculousness that it is. And it's a nice little break. And I feel like when people kind of join in with their own comments, they're just kind of trying to get in on that laughter, and I totally allow them that. The only thing that ever frustrates me is, you know, I can always handle my own with trolls. Mm-hmm. And I'll get these, like, white knights and, like, sis, you okay? Do you need me to come in and fix this for you? No, I don't need you to fix this for me. I've got this handled. And they know I've got it handled. That's the only time I ever get, like, what are you doing? Is when people, like, offer to, you know, just off my shoulders. You know, take care of it for me. I'm taking care of it. If I didn't want to take care of it, I'd be ignoring it. But for the most part, you know, people really do need a little bit of laughter at the ridiculousness of these people to really bring it down to the, you know, complete ignorance that's behind this childish malice, you know, that leads grown adults to troll other humans they don't even know on the internet, saying racist things they would never dream of saying in public. Like, when you break it down, like, that's a really sad hobby. Like, that's, there's something that's gone very wrong in your life if that's what you're doing. And, you know, when I troll people, I mean, when I, like, troll back the trolls, I'm just bringing that to light. You know, I'm just, having a conversation about getting me coffee is a heck of a lot more useful than a conversation about, you know, the endangerment of the white race that these guys were trying to send me.
Absolutely.
It still was absolutely, again, brilliant and hilarious. When I troll back, I'm usually just like, I don't know, one of two things. Either I'm very just kind of relaxed. I'm like, yeah, you're just stupid. Like, I just really don't care. I'm like, well, whatever. And by other times I get kind of angry and have fun. But again, it's kind of cathartic for me. I don't do it often, and people always complain, like, oh, why are you feeding the trolls, very white guy, stop it. I'm like, ah, because it's fucking fun.
Yeah, they're gonna be out there doing it. You know what was interesting to see, actually, is there's, you know, Lindy West? She's a feminist writer in Seattle. She's actually married my brother. She gets trolled harder than just about anyone I know. In fact, she was on This American Life talking about someone who made a Twitter account of her recently deceased father and trolled her.
I read that. Wait a minute. You said she's married to somebody?
She's married my brother.
Oh. We listened to that episode of This American Life.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I know who this is. Yeah, absolutely. Her deceased father. Yeah. Holy cow. Yeah. Small world.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting to watch is some horribly sad inept troll actually makes videos of him trolling people. And he made a video of him trolling Lindy, like a live video of him on the computer. And what's interesting to see is just how desperate these guys are to get an emotional response out of people. Like, to say, yeah, I see you, you're here, and you have enough power to make me upset. On the watch, this guy, like, troll, and then you would hear him go, oh, that's disappointing. She just blocked me. She didn't say anything. Oh, that's disappointing. She laughed at me. Okay, let me try this. This will make her mad. And he's actually, like, narrating this horribly sad exercise trying to seem relevant.
That's got to get him off somehow. He's getting some sort of deranged pleasure. And now, Wendy, when she confronted the troll, she got on, like, air with the guy. And he apologized. Yeah. And his, again, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was like, you know, I just did it to fucking do it. Like, he had no rationale behind it at all, because he could was why he did it.
Yeah. It was really like he was sad about his life. You know, to see a fat woman happy life made him feel shitty, and he wanted to take that from her.
That is just, you know, on some level, and I've never used this word before, but I pity that individual. You're that unhappy in your own life that the sole pleasure you get out of is tearing down somebody who's happier in their life than you are? That's pathetic.
It is. They are definitely pathetic. Today you had one, or a couple of days ago, that you literally got this woman who started off calling you a horrible name and she ended up sending you a kiss at the end. So I haven't, yeah. I haven't seen a troll that successful, a back troll that successful ever.
That was weird. I know, that was funny because it was, you know, when someone sends you something like that vile, you can't even take it seriously at that point, you know? Like, I'm just like, oh, you know, okay, love you too, you know? And it's just, I want to give them the exact opposite of what they're giving me. So they expect me, you know, when they start throwing racist epithets my way and vile things my way, they expect me to be shocked and appalled. And if I just come back with, oh man, you know, you're so romantic, that's so sweet, it throws me completely off guard. But I wouldn't expect, usually they just go away. Or, like, sometimes it's really funny because I'll just be like, oh my gosh, you're the best. And they'll be like, stop attacking me. And she isn't sad, but she asked me to stop. She said, stop. I'm like,
she didn't, and then she fell in love with you, just like that. It's like Stockholm Syndrome or something.
You know that you're saying that they want the reaction, they want the emotional response. I've stopped blocking. I just mute. You know, there's no real need for me to block, and I feel like blocking, you're like, oh, I'm blocked by a very white guy. He couldn't handle it. Ha-ha. Like, no, I'm just like, fuck it, I'll just mute you. And, you know, I haven't blocked anybody in months. I just mute's much, I don't want to say easier for me, but it works the same, so I don't bother blocking.
You know what I love about muting too is the fact that there's some like angry dude shaking his fist and we're not even seeing it. It's beautiful. That's what I love about it. Like,
me too.
He's literally like living the impotence that he has in real life on the internet by yelling at someone who can't even see what he's saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's almost like the visual would be like someone screaming at a brick wall. Like just like, ah! Ah! You look silly. You know what? I don't know if you've got them, but so Elon on Twib did a whole episode on these white genocide wackadoos, and I tweeted a bunch, and he retweeted some of it, and they just came out the fucking woodwork today. My mentions were just rife with like the just and these I call them like intellectual racists.
I think they're crazy, those but white genocide ones.
Well, and they try to couch it in some sort of just it's an asinine supposition, but they are just absolutely the most vile. Ugh.
Yeah, it makes no sense either. Like, you read, like, they send you things, and they expect these to be the things that, like, get you going, and you're just like, wow, like, I'm in, like, you know, with that whole, like, Starbucks thing, for some reason, that triggered the white supremacists, and they were coming after me, I don't know why, and I was like, wow, well, if this is a state of white supremacy, I think they're good, because this is like, don't get basic concepts of anything, you know, it's okay.
Yeah. They're completely delusional.
You said cogent before, and that's true. There's nothing cogent about those arguments at all. And they like demand a response. Like, you need to answer me. I'm right until you prove me wrong about my erroneous, you know, logical fallacy that's totally ridiculous. But prove me wrong, goddammit.
I really feel like it's like these white guys are literally taking their dicks out and whacking them against the keyboard going, look at my dick. Somebody look at it. Like, that's pretty much all that it is. That's all they're doing.
You're giving me a lot of really fun visuals. Thank you. Next time I have a troll, I'm going to have to get a meme, just like somebody like smacking their penis on a keyboard. This is you right now, dude. This is you. Man, look at my penis, man.
Oh, it's so funny. That's so true. I think angry black lady calls it white dude Twitter. So, yeah, that's what white dude Twitter looks like. For sure.
Dude whacking his penis
that's
on a
it.
Keyboard.
That is the epitome of white dude Twitter. It's the truth. It's the truth. So I wanted to talk. I read this post that you did a couple years ago on your blog, which is herhonestlife.com. And it was entitled, Where Are My White Friends At?
Mm.
And I really loved the piece because it's been something that I think has been coming up a lot more, not just on the micro level in terms of people's lives, which it definitely is. And I've spoken to so many people that white and black, I'll say, and every other color for that matter, that have decided to speak out about Black Lives Matter or make this an important part of their lives. And the silence that they receive on the other end. And then they put a cat picture up and like everybody likes it. And it's like, what the fuck? I've been posting about people's deaths for the last 2 months. You haven't said a goddamn word. And now my cat has gotten you to jump to and actually let me know you've been reading all of this stuff this whole time and just didn't care to respond.
Yeah, but look at him. He looks like a four-leaf clover. We dressed him up for St. Patrick's Day. He's so fucking cute. Oh, chin.
But then also on the macro level, I've also been seeing this being challenged within a lot of white liberal progressive organizations, Oxfam, our own religious faith, Unitarian Universalists, this weekend at Amnesty International. So the piece was obviously really well written, and I'll post a direct link to it as well. Have you seen, this was written in 2013, so do you think things have gotten better for you in terms of where are your white friends, or worse since you wrote the piece?
You know, in all honesty, I wrote that letter in Trayvon Martin, and that was at a critical, like, crisis time for me. That's actually really why I started writing, was that immense isolation. I felt like I was going to go insane. Like, I cried. I almost had a breakdown. Like, just living in a predominantly white area and seeing the absolute silence about something so important to me and my family, with the people I grew up with, you know? And I can't say that it got better. I can't say that my friends learned. In all honesty, who I am now, 2 years later, is a person with a completely different set of friends. It actually did end a lot of my relationships when you realize that people aren't there for you. When you realize that the empathy stops here, and that your opinion of community ends here, and that these supposed to be liberal, friends of yours don't see their kid in your kid, and they don't think, oh my gosh, this could be me, this is not right. They don't think this is my problem too, and the discomfort of having a conversation about race is more important for them to avoid that.
Yeah. White comfort.
Take action that could
powerful.
Help, the people they call friends. So, it was true then and it's true today, but I think it was a good wake up for me to, realize where I was at. Now, that being said, I have a lot of truly genuine white friends who, may not be perfect. None of us are, but are honest enough, to be open to learning about from another perspective, or at least saying, I don't fully understand, but I'm here for you and I want to understand. But I had to go find those people because they weren't the majority at all. And that was so depressing and sad. And I think a lot of people go through that. I literally was begging at that point. I was begging my friends. That was a plea to my friends. That wasn't even a writing piece. I wasn't a writer then. That was a plea to my friends, saying, please,
honestly, Leslie,
I need somebody here.
You did the same thing, Leslie. You did it on Facebook.
Yeah.
You wrote, it wasn't word for word, obviously. It wouldn't, plagiarize your blog. But same sentiment, Like, this is who I am. This is what I'm going through. This is, I'm feeling the silence and the pain. Where, if you're my friend, you need to reach out to me now. Like, almost, not, verbatim, but that was what it was. And I don't want to say we were surprised or disappointed, but it was I can kind of say that day was the dividing rod between who was going to be our friends and who wasn't going to be, because there was silence from, not conspicuously a lot of people.
There is a woman at our church that literally, when Drew walks in there, runs the other way physically. That is how much in denial she is. Like, it's palpable, and it's true. It becomes a part where you're joined. And actually, to me, it's sort of at the heart of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is just Black people being like, yeah, this is enough now. And I'm not going to let you dictate pretty much anything now. That's it. I'm done. I'm done with it. And we're not going to tiptoe around this. This shit is your fault. And you're benefiting from it. And I'm sick of just allowing you to just deny it and live and breathe in that denial at all. And it does just change the people that you have around you, because when people get the message and they're like, oh wait, she's not going to just take that anymore, it completely alters the interactions that they're willing to have with you. And they're not willing, they don't care enough about you in reality to go any further than that. And that's a perfect way of putting it, which is the empathy stops there, and they let you know pretty clearly where it stops. So this weekend, I mentioned that I went to the Amnesty International General Assembly. So did Drew. He was there for one day. And, I have to say, it was, for me, I was really hesitant about signing up for it, because I know how these large you know, non-for-profit, let's help the world type of organizations are. And basically just means a lot of white people talking about, you know, saving dissidents in China and going to Peru to help the farmers without at all looking at the ways in which they themselves and their organization perpetuate white supremacy and the human rights of black people are trampled on a daily basis on their own soil. Especially given the fact that Amnesty International is an entity, the first ever action that they had or observation that they had in the United States was at Ferguson last summer. So that just gives you an idea about how delusional Amnesty International USA is in terms of, you know, their own things that they need to come to terms with, which is that human rights starts here. And you have not addressed any of those human rights. So why are you going all over the globe and starting all these things without even looking at the things that are going on in our own country? So in addition to that, they brought in a lot of Ferguson protesters and leaders from the Black Lives Matter movement for a series of panels. They had almost every session block. They had at least one panel devoted to this issue. And, you know, going to the sessions, it just felt like, you know, they wanted to have these people put their pain on display. You know, these white people wanted to just hear what the tear gas was like. They wanted to, you know, feel like they listened to whoever, you know, whether it was DeRay or Netta or, you know, Miss Pacchetti or whoever, that's what they wanted, to have this moment of, you know, hearing this, you know, straight from the person that was there, kind of thing. And it was really hollow, as you can imagine, because it just doesn't work that way. And if you want to help in liberation, it's not about you clapping for people that are already working and doing the work. It's you actually doing something. You know, they're not there to just talk about this thing. It's about the work. And they also failed to create a really good space for the Black Caucus, the Black attendees. And this includes employees of theirs. And so Saturday evening, the Black members and the Black attendees at the conference just created their own caucus space. And they talked about many issues, including, you know, the treatment and the feeling that the Black people that work for Amnesty International USA have been feeling, which is ignored. As you would imagine in such a workplace, it's very harmful to them. They feel like they don't get to do the work that they've been hired to do.
Am I not mistaken that they had on Saturday night a space for Black, like a Black caucus, because they didn't make one for them?
Yes, they created it themselves.
And at this event, some of the workers in positions at Amnesty International USA were in tears.
Tears.
It wasn't just traumatizing. It was like really traumatizing.
So an impromptu action was decided. The final plenary included amazing woman Rosa Clemente, who's run for vice president before, and she's amazing. She actually used to work for Amnesty and got fired because of these exact issues. And
can I just say, I don't think I've seen or been in the room with more unbelievable Black women that don't give a fuck in my life. It was awesome. It was awesome, man. Kay Ray, her. Oh, there's so many. I was just like, this is powerful.
It was. So there was a Q&A at the end of the discussion, which was on sustaining and growing our movement. And so I'm going to play a recording of that very...
Of Rosa?
No, of the action itself.
Okay.
So here we go.
So what I wanted to say too, and I'm glad that you called that out.
This is Erica Totten.
Really funky. I was excited when I came. My name is Erica Totten. I'm an organizer and activist in D.C. and been in Ferguson in a lot of different areas. But I'm all about accountability. And when I heard your experience, Rosa, about being in this organization that did not affirm your leadership and did not agree with how you went about Black liberation work, is a problem for me, because now we have this message of bringing human rights home, and we know that the movement in this country is Black Lives Matter, and we know that this country is based off and built off of white supremacy, so Black liberation work has to be the focus of your organization. Mm-hmm. There is no question about it. But you cannot tell Black people how to get free. So you have to have spaces, create and give up your privilege and give up your power to people who are directly affected by this and know how to do it better than you, because we live it.
Thank you.
So you have to give that up. And so ultimately, with this, the reason why I am saying this, because it's connected. I have brothers and sisters that are in this organization that were directly such impactful voices in the Black Lives Matter movement. And now that they're here, we will be holding Amnesty International, Amnesty USA, whatever. We will be holding you accountable. This is my first time really understanding you all, because I saw you as a white organization that really did not do anything for Black people in this country. So we have demands. The first one is from the movement right now, because if you're taking the narrative, we will be holding you accountable for what you say you will do in this country. And so the first demand is all board members, executive staff, and all managers must go through a continued series of trainings and establish accountability and performance measures on equity in the workplace, including but not limited to racial identity development, white middle class dominant culture in the workplace, and anti-racism training. That's demand one. Demand number two, put Black people in managerial positions within Amnesty that focus on Black liberation work in the United States with resources equal to your work in other countries. Fully funded. Demand number three, create satellite Amnesty offices in U.S. cities where Black liberation work is happening right now. Don't come into our movement, take our people, remove them from their community, and then have them focus on Jordan and Syria when Black people are dying right here in this country. It's psychologically violent to pull someone out of their own movement and say, and sell them a dream and say, this is what you're going to do, and then flip the script on them, our main voices in the movement, and you tell them, I need you to focus on these five other states that have nothing to, it might be things going on there, but where their home is, where people are dying right now, you are taking them away and you are putting them in other areas, and it looks like COINTELPRO. That's what it looks like, because that's what happens. You take our best and our brightest, and you dim their light. You crush their spirit with racism in your organization. You take their power, and they feel powerless, and they forget who they are. And we are the ones that have to end up holding them up and holding them up with their spirit and pouring back into them. And it's exhausting. So we will be holding you accountable. We will not allow you to break our people and steal them from us, because they are too important. So if you are saying that you are bringing human rights home, we are holding you accountable. And these are our three demands, and they better be met. Woo! Because you know we shut it down. No question about it. Those are our three demands. If you have questions about anything, I'm more than willing to have a conversation. But we will be, and I'm talking about all of us in the Black Lives Matter movement.
Thank you. Thank you. All right.
That was some truth right there.
Yes, it was. So after the demands were read, and as each one was read, a member of the caucus brought a huge sheet of paper with each demand written on it up to the front and stood in front of the panel. Everyone was taking pictures. Then there was some call and response. If we don't get it, shut it down. And then everybody got up and did the Asada quote. It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. So that was the whole action. And then really everybody left the room. I stayed, DeRay stayed, Drew stayed. I really wanted to see what was going to happen after this. I mean, you just heard it. It's incredibly moving. It's incredibly powerful. And more importantly, it's incredibly truthful. So this woman got up right after this. Well, first she was announced, and there was no acknowledgement of any, you know, that anything had even occurred. And then she went to discuss the 2015, and I'm going to quote her here, Get on the Bus 2015 initiative. And she went through her four main actions that were going to be part of this nationwide Get on the Bus initiative. and none of them took place in the United States.
One of them was a letter writing campaign. Nothing wrong with it, to get one jailed dissident out in China. And they talked about the thousands of letters and all the work and all the stuff they did to get this guy out. And I was like, wow, one dude.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not even about that. It just was so obvious that it was, you know, I think one of them is in China and Tibet. One was in Sri Lanka. One was in Azerbaijan. And the other was in Russia and Ukraine. And then they had some side actions. Again, none of them in the United States. And it just goes to show how much lip service they had been delivering with this idea, because they named the whole conference From Moment to Movement. So they were borrowing from the Black Lives Matter movement, borrowing from the idea of what Ferguson has become, and not even taking to heart what it means. And it's just, what were your thoughts on all that?
I mean, that was amazing to hear, because it's something that I think I come across a lot. It's the weirdest thing, I think, is like, you know, I think there's a reason why, you know, you don't have, like, the Chinese government protesting the release of Chinese dissidents. It's the same way, right? You don't see white people protesting for, you know, improvement of day-to-day lives of black people, because they are the ones directly benefiting from that, and no matter how good they seem, there's this blind spot there. And it's amazing to me that if so many of these people can't point and go, there's the bad person, way over there, they don't want to have a part of it. And I think what she was saying sums a lot of it up. There's a lot of, no, focus on this. Look, here's something way worse that you should be looking at right now. Because they know that eventually that's going to come back to them. And it's going to have to come back to something that they're going to have to change in their day-to-day lives and how they handle business. And that's definitely something that people want to avoid. And I think that's something we keep coming up across. And I think that's a problem we have with allies time and time again, is that people don't understand how personally invested they are in the system that they say they're trying to take down. Mm-hmm. And as long as they can point to someone else and say they're the problem, they're okay. But the moment it seems like they're going to have to actually dismantle the parts that they benefit from, you know, that becomes a problem, because it not only is it a problem because it's inconvenient, but what does it say about you? What does it say about you if you say, I hate racism and I'm for justice? Oh, but, you know, I'm 40, and for the last 40 years I've been, you know, happily lapping up the profits of this injustice system. I've said nothing, you know, as the school-to-prison pipeline has been locking up children across the country. I've done nothing, you know. I voted, you know, for law enforcement bills that, you know, increase stop and frisk. And I've cut education funding that's based on income in neighborhoods instead of equitably, so that I ensure that poor kids stay poor. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these things that you do day-to-day life, you don't even look at it and go, oh, gosh, am I really as good as I said I am? Because every single day, everything I do holds up the system. And that's, I think people go desperately to avoid that.
It's so true.
And Leslie, you say that all the time, that's one of the not the biggest impediments, but a large impediment, is that for this change to happen, a lot of us white people are going to have to come to the realization that, you know, like, we're pretty fucking mediocre. Like, we're just
super mediocre.
You know? We're not all fucking special, and, you know, we did it by our bootstraps. Can't you too? Like, you know, like,
and just stop being so damn self-congratulatory, and you aren't impressive. Like, it doesn't impress me that you got
made it to be CEO. Have you seen my penis on the keyboard? You're saying I'm not impressive. I'm gonna pull my wang out on this fucking keyboard.
No, it's true. I mean, that too is unimpressive.
Wait a
minute.
That white dude Twitter. Listen and hear me now, and listen well. Yeah.
I just
Well, the thing too, I think that we forget, right, is, you know, we talk about race because it's one of the biggest things out there. You know, this blind spot, it's not, you know, solely a blind spot white people have, right? I know plenty of people who fight against racial oppression because it's what affects their day of their lives, but their ableist is shit. Right? Or that homophobic is can be. Mm-hmm. These things we all have to look at. I'm constantly, you know, coming across privilege I didn't even realize I was benefiting from. I'm constantly hitting where you have that visual response. How dare you say that to me? And you realize, oh, crap. you know, this is my area that I haven't worked at yet. We all have those areas that we need to look at. Racism just happens to be one of the most profitable, so it's one of the most popular.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all, you know, when we look at, you know, trans people being murdered day in and day out, when we look at, you know, the amount of abuse that mentally disabled people encounter every day that no one talks about, when we look at all of these things that we gloss over because, you know, it would be really too inconvenient to look at ableist language, you know. Really, times I've, you know, one of the most virulent fights I ever saw online was about ableist language.
Mm.
And people were like, I know, well, you know, that's just ridiculous. That's ridiculous, you know, for me to start looking at these words. I mean, just how inconvenient is that? And realize these same people fighting for feminism, fighting against racism, couldn't extend that same to people with, you know, different mental capabilities and functions. You know, you realize we all have our work to do. So it's not something where it's just like, oh man, only white people, like they have some special gene that allows them to, you know, like not see their privilege. It's just they happen to have the most of it. Like they just got all that privilege. It's really obvious. It's attracting a ton of people. But we're all somewhere on the ladder.
True, true. I do think not only is it the bigger and more obviously profitable, but I think as a, for just as a white person, as like a, as a reflex, like defending supremacy, it comes so naturally. It just, it's almost like a, like we've trained that muscle really, really well. You know, I think like at some point, like you start defending some other things, like, okay, this is kind of, you know, and I, and what you were describing in terms of, you know, like different, I think of it as a lens, like my lens for racial disparity, racially disparate outcomes is really attenuated pretty good. Like I can see it, you know, pretty easily, but for patriarchal conditioning, not as much. And for ableist language, even less, you know, and I'm guilty of, you know, using, you know, language that, you know, people have told me, hey, that's not cool. And I've said, I'm going to try and do better. And, you know, I probably don't do as much work on the ableist side. I've been working, I think, pretty hard on my patriarchal conditioning. Leslie's been also checking me a lot on that.
Well, I think, that what Ijoma said is really like, pointed because we do all have certain privileges that we come to the table with. I mean, there are plenty of spaces within the Black Lives Matter movement that I have to check my own personal privilege. Like I may be more educated than the people that are in need of help. I may be more financially stable than they are. I have to defer to them in those moments. It's not for me to tell somebody who is trying to liberate themselves from a situation I've already liberated myself from, whether it be education or finances or whatever it might be, to tell them how to do that. It's for me to shut the fuck up and listen to what they have to say and then support them in what they want to do. And so it's something that everybody has to learn. I think with white people though, you literally have never had to step outside yourself and think about something from anybody else's other position. It's always centered on how you feel. Black people and people of color, and even to some extent women, have to think about what does a white male think in this situation, and then they can think about how they feel about it, because they have to react the way to whatever the white male perception is going to be. They have to think about what that reaction is going to be, because it will affect them so significantly. What has changed is that we just don't give a fuck what your reception is anymore. And it is a rude awakening, and it is that awakening of like, yeah, a lot of you are going to have to come to terms with you're not that impressive. Oh, you got to be a CEO and so what? There was an artist this weekend that had this whole thing. He had done this really amazing. He's a famous artist. I can't remember his name right now. Maybe I can look it up. But he had this huge project he did with inmates, men that were locked up. And he said that, you know, it was the first time that they had, you know, kind of had space to really express themselves artistically in such a large format. Painting is huge canvases and things like that. And Jesse Crimes, that's his name. And it was actually here in Philadelphia. And so they had to be sentenced to at least a 70-month prison term in order to do this work with him. And so he said that it was so obvious to him that they were not only in most cases just as good as he was as an artist, even though he was making all this money off of his art, most of them were more talented than he was. And he had to really like come to terms with the fact that shit, The only reason why they're there and I'm here is our skin color. There's nothing special about me. They would be exactly as successful as I am if they were white. And it was like, oh, shit. I'm not nearly as amazing as I have told myself that I am, you know, this artistic genius. And there is a lot of that, those kind of come to terms situations that are going to have to happen.
It's funny too, because they don't realize that that whole system that they're benefiting from is also the system that holds up all their accolades. You know, I had a dude who would laugh because he didn't like my Kimmy Schmidt article. Which just, Artemis doesn't understand what racism is. And I'm like, hey, thanks, my dude, for telling me what racism is. And he was so offended that I would question his ability to speak on racism that he sent me a private message on Facebook with his entire resume of race work.
And he's like, oh, for good Lord.
And I'm just like, oh, did you win a Pulitzer in being black? Is that what you won? Because unless they're giving out that award, I don't give a fuck. Like, it's none of these. And it was so funny because he was just spitting out, you know, I have 8 people that work for me. Okay. I don't, none of this flies here. You cannot spend any of that credit here. And it was just amazing to see, like, how dare you take these things that, you know, mean so much to the white world and show that they don't matter to you. They don't matter to me.
Nor should they. And that was one of the first, I think the only blog I've ever, I've maybe written 2 blog posts, but one of the first ones after Mike Brown's death was specifically like about that, like just white people, you cannot, you know, tell black people how to think, feel, react, and just, you know, you can sympathize, but you can't really empathize. You cannot walk a mile in their shoes. It's just not possible. You just can't, don't try to do it. You know, not don't try to do it, but just, you know, don't act like you know. And that's what this guy was doing. He was acting like he knows. I'm going to tell you. He's white-splaining. I'm going to tell you.
Yeah. Well, I think honestly that I hate that phrase like walk a mile in someone's shoes, because I feel like it is one of the greatest blocks to empathy we have. Mm. Because when you hit that wall where you can't walk in it, you invalidate it. Mm. So when you get to where you go, you know what, I imagine I wouldn't feel that. And then you cut it off, right? But the truth is that every person is in their own right able to interpret and communicate their own experience. And if you can't take that at face value, then that means that you do not respect their experience as much as you respect your own. And it should take nothing more than their words and their interpretation of their experience for you to care.
Yeah,
and
that's a good point.
Walk a mile in their shoes. You have to see what it's like from their point of view.
That's a really good point.
It's absolutely ridiculous because they already see what it's like from their point of view, and they're telling you, and that should be enough.
You know what you're saying is even that idiom is steeped in white sentiment.
It is.
It really is. I never thought about it. I don't think I used that phrase. I think I said something like it's impossible, almost like, you know, it's like the, I think I called it the oxygen that we live and breathe. It's like atmosphere. How are you going to describe water to a fish? It's just, you know, but walk a mile in your shoes is centering on whiteness. You're absolutely right.
It is completely centering on whiteness, and it's this idea of
the need. It instantly allows you to invalidate other people's words and narrative. Like, oh, I, you know, whatever.
And it also sets up just something that's going to be completely detrimental or make the process of black liberation in this country so much more difficult. And we saw this with gay marriage where, you know, senator or whoever would be like, I'm against gay marriage. Gay marriage is terrible, blah, blah, blah. And then their nephew is gay or their sister is gay. And they're like, I've changed my mind because they had a personal connection. But you're probably not going to happen to have a loved one turn black. So,
yeah, nothing's more insulting than when you get those emails from dudes who are like, you know, this is why I love interracial relationships, because if we all just, you know, start having sex with each other and make their own babies, racism will go away. No, that didn't work. Ask Thomas Jefferson. He still owned slaves after he had a ton of interracial babies. But this whole weirdness of, you know, once it passes white, you know, experience, it'll be cool. Like, no.
Yeah, that's like the like genetic, like I don't even know what that is, like version of like melting pot assimilation. I haven't heard that one yet. That like that's the solution is like.
Oh God, I hear that all the time. Maybe
really?
It's because I am actually a black woman, and so it's like white dudes like, hey, have you ever heard of
Like, name like the top five worst pickup lines ever. It's that right there.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah. 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 It's really gross. It happens so often. I'm like, dude, your penis will not solve racism. It won't.
Ew.
Like, there's nothing, you know. But it's one of those things where people are like, you know, hey, have you ever tried, you know, making it something that, you know, that like directly affects white people? Because that will solve it. And we shouldn't have to do that.
Right, and that's exactly the point, is that if that's what we're waiting for, is fuck white is white people's moral compass to kick in, man, we're going to be waiting a long time. We've been waiting a long time.
You know, we've now referenced, like, penises, like two or three different times.
Nice.
You know, his pinned tweet, nobody cares about your boner. And it's got a little cat. You got to look at it.
I saw that, yes. That's your fabulous illustrator work. I've been very impressed with it. It's
nobody
awesome.
Cares about your boner.
The internet is seriously just white dudes like, look at my boner, like, all the time, and you're just like, no, put it away, I don't care about it.
Oh my goodness. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. First of all, please tell everyone, if they already don't know, which I'm sure they do, where they can find you and your work,
please.
You know, what your handle is, all of that stuff. Let us all know.
Oh, okay. Well, my handle on Twitter is Ejoba Oluo, and that should be on the site because it's difficult to spell. And my website is ejobaoluo.com, which is where I try and update a lot of my writing. But almost everything I do can be found on Twitter as well.
Awesome. And we, fantastic. Of course, definitely will be sharing all of the links and everything. But again, just thank you so much for joining us. And we will continue, of course, spreading the gospel of Ijeoma as far and wide as we can.
And now, is there any way to support you other than just consuming your writing and enjoying it and enjoying your content? There's no other, like, you have a book coming out or anything we can support you?
No, you know, I have an agent. I am working on writing a book proposal. So really, right now, it's just about keeping, you know, my audience up and, you know, honing my skills and what I'm known for. So you guys have been absolutely wonderful. I love the conversations that you guys start and you guys have. It's always fun to interact with you. And, you know, I hope people just keep seeing you online and talking, and I'll let you know what comes up.
Definitely.
Please do.
Will.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much. And have a great night. Thanks so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you. This has been an absolute
have
pleasure.
A great night.
What a joy.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
So thanks again. I mean, that was probably the best thing ever that ever happened.
I can't
to
believe
us
it.
Ever.
I don't know if Johnners know, but like, so when we were first chatting with her a little bit on Twitter, like interacting.
Oh,
with
we should have talked to her about this.
Well, that's okay. She can listen to it. and she said something like, oh, I listened to the show. I really like it. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe she listened to the show. And I said, oh, you totally have to come on. And she's like, you know, okay, I'll think about it. And then there was something else she said a little bit later. And I was like, oh, that's a Twitter contract. You got to come on the show now. And it was like a joke. Like, I was just kind of like fucking around. But she really came on the show. Like,
yeah. Ding, 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 oh my God. Just thank you so much again. And again, we'll have all of those links on the show notes. And this has just been the most amazing conversation.
How fun. And you know what? She really is like fucking hilarious.
Oh, so funny.
I haven't laughed so much. And no disrespect to other
so
guests.
So funny.
I haven't laughed that much. And we say that the episode is going to be called Privilege Wrapped in a Fur Coat.
Yeah, white privilege.
But it might just be boner on a keyboard.
I don't know.
It's too
oh,
much.
No. Now we got to think about it.
Too much. Do
she
we have
gave
to
us so much. No, let's get through the rest of this stuff.
Okay.
So there's this really amazing venue here in Philadelphia called the Mann Center. And it's an outdoor music venue. Obviously, it's only during nice weather. And they do all sorts of concerts there and like some festivals kind of stuff.
And I want to say it's owned by the city in some
right.
sort of weird sort
some
of like
weird,
you
know,
co-op. Like,
yeah.
you know,
it's in the middle
all
of Fairmont
supported by
Park.
Various places. Right. It's not a very... it's out the off the beaten path, and it was a underdeveloped area, and it's got a beautiful view of the city, and they have food trucks.
It's like on a hill.
It's a pretty sweet place to see
great.
A concert.
So we had seen like a few concerts there, mm-hmm. and we saw last summer. I don't know if they did it any other summer, but last summer was the first time I saw it. But they did a series of concert/movies with the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra, where they would have like an iconic movie that has an amazing score, and the Philharmonic would play the score live during the movie.
So just it's clear like. What we watch
West Side Story.
So the movie they're playing, they're projecting it onto the side of the auditorium, and it's outdoor venue. So they're broadcasting the movie, and the movie's playing with all the dialogue and all the sound effects, just not the musical score. So it's like a weird version of the movie that's missing the musical score.
And then they provide the score.
Correct.
Live in front of you.
As a full-on symphony orchestra. Correct. Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra. Correct. Like 60-some-odd piece orchestra.
Right.
So it's now a fun experience.
Yeah. So we had gone to like a bunch of other concerts there. And usually, like, you can't bring anything in there. You have to buy their food. They have Correct. Food trucks sometimes. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And then they have like the regular concession bullshit, like hot dogs, hamburgers, whatever.
Right.
So.
And they're strict about it.
Right. I got, and when you go to any, when you have tickets, they send you like an email, like prepare for
exactly.
your blah, blah.
No backpacks, no right. chairs, blah, 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 blah,
so
blah.
I get, or you can bring chairs, some you can, some you can't. So I get an email for the West Side Story, and it's like, you can bring in food. You can bring in alcoholic beverages. You can bring in a chair. You can bring in blankets. Basically, you can bring anything you fucking want to this thing. And I said to Drew, I was like, this is so weird. They're letting us bring food in. So, you know, we thought we'd go get,
like Whole Foods,
yeah,
or Wegmans.
Whole Foods. We had some sandwiches made up.
Out, some
we
desserts.
Had, you know, some desserts.
We thought we were rolling pretty good.
Yeah, we thought we get to this fucking thing.
Man, white people don't play.
They had like kegs. Wine bucket.
When she says kegs, she means one of those like
pony
mini,
kegs.
Like not even a pony keg, the little like 5 liter kind of
yeah.
like.
But they
Heineken
like
deal.
Rolled Still. It into this venue.
Yeah, they came.
And
deep.
It
they
struck
deep.
Us, and I this only came up this week because The Godfather is going to be played there, and we're about to buy tickets for that particular one. I think it'll be a good. Obviously, that score is awesome, but that they had created this space where this was for sure the whitest.
Oh yeah.
Event that we had been to at this venue, and for sure the highest
income bracket.
Not that the tickets were that expensive, because they weren't compared to other things, but that the average, you know,
wealth of the attendee
was huge. And here, when it's a lower income base and more people of color, they
charge for food
and charge them for food. And when these people who can afford to buy anything they want are going to be there,
bring in all
they
the
let
shit
them
you
bring
want.
Anything they want yep. in. It's just like, what the fuck, man? Man.
I think their logic, and I'm not saying that it doesn't support supremacy, but I'm assuming their logic is these are people that donate or do this or that. Or
that's your assumption, though.
Yeah.
That's your assumption. We don't donate.
No, we don't.
And we were there.
Yeah, that's true.
The people we were with don't donate.
It was kind of fucked up.
It is not just was. It continues to be fucked up because I.
Well, you don't know it's going to be that way. We'll see.
Oh, it'll be like that again. Trust.
If it is and we go, I'm fucking. It's cooler time. I ain't fucking around. I'm gonna bring some serious.
Well, if
fucking,
anybody, I think tickets go on sale this Friday. So if anybody in Philly wants to join us, make a little John trip. Well, we can do that. We want to talk about some TV.
Yeah, dude. So the show Barely Famous.
Yeah.
And I guess it's a, I'm going to use like quotes like reality show, but
it's
really
a faux
not,
reality
it's a faux
show.
Reality
right?
show.
I guess that's now a actual
a thing.
Thing.
Yeah, because
yeah.
Valerie Cherish was a.
Yep. No, that wasn't a faux reality show because she wasn't playing herself. The one that has Matt LeBlanc is a faux reality show.
Okay, got it. Pucks.
Where you play yourself.
Episodes.
Yeah, episodes where you play yourself, but
it's a faux reality.
Yeah,
okay.
Faux reality.
So Barely Famous, faux reality, and it stars, who is it? The
David
music,
Foster's. Daughters, basically.
A movie music producer.
Yeah. Well, people know who David Foster is. You just don't.
I don't. But it's absolutely hilarious.
Well, one of them is a writer and one of them is a not very successful actress. And so there's a lot of like it is, I think, satire. It's satire of the movie business, of their privilege, of the life that they are able to lead. And it's great because it just works really well in that way because those things deserve to be made fun of. And also, they're deadpan. Their timing is really good.
Reality TV personality Aaron Foster Uh-oh. Breaks up handicapped Auto-pro. Man's marriage and then immediately dumps
clip.
Him. Reality TV personality?
It's so degrading.
Action.
I'm Aaron. I'm Sarah.
Yo,
bro.
Wow.
Who's your dad?
Our dad is David Foster. He is a successful music producer. Because of that,
we've been asked to do 10 reality shows.
But we would never do a reality show that's...
Yeah, we're private people.
What's happening here?
With what?
You doing a reality show?
A what? That's super insulting.
Sarah, why are you naked in front of the crew?
They thought it would be an interesting scene.
It is. It's so interesting.
So anyways, there's just a few choice things. But it's very funny. It's on VH1. Actually comes on tonight. So it comes on Wednesday nights. I think it's at 8:30 or 9:30. One of the
They're both really funny.
They are very funny.
And they have great timing.
Yes. And I appreciate the humor in it. And it's very funny. So if you like that sort of thing and would like to see these white people make fools of themselves, check it out. But much more fucking importantly.
Podcast standing time.
Much more motherfucking importantly, I have to give all hail Kid Fury, Crystal, Asante, my dude Dustin.
Dude, Dustin's just dusted. He's blazed.
So Kid Fury, you can find obviously one half of this of the Reed podcast, has started a new video web series called The Green Experiment with Crystal and Asante and Dustin, who have made occasional appearances on the Reed and are fucking hilarious. And it's just them, the four of them, hanging out, chilling, and experimenting with some green. And it's I think there's four episodes so far.
Are they in New York or
they
California?
Are in New York. I started watching one of them and I stopped it immediately because I knew I had to watch it with you, because I was like, oh my god, I can't watch this by myself, because it was so, I was crying.
It was really funny.
It is so funny.
They got what's that card game?
Oh yeah,
Cards Humanity.
Cards Against Humanity.
Oh man, they were hilarious.
They played that. They played like Password. They play all sorts. They play games, and it's just them kind of interacting, and it's just edited perfectly. And they're so funny, and the whole thing is just brilliance. And Dustin's the best.
You know what? I don't know if he's got like the lowest tolerance or he's taking the biggest hits or something, but he is just. I ain't never seen somebody that wasted.
He's
like two steps from putting
and
his head down.
And he's eating and almost
constantly
eating.
Straight munchies the whole time.
So funny. It's so funny.
It's pretty goddamn hilarious.
It's just.
But I don't think they do it very often. It only looks like maybe once a month.
They just started it.
They have three episodes?
They have four episodes. It hasn't been that long. So
okay.
I don't think it's been. I think they said more to come on the last. On the last.
What's a high, get it? Did I do it there?
Yeah.
High recommend.
So the first one was February 26th. So that wasn't that long ago.
Four?
Yeah. So
That's one a week.
Yeah. So I think that's what I think the expectation would be, somewhere around there. Because I think they hang out every week anyway. So, I mean, I'm sure it's predicated on that, generally speaking.
You know, and I do love The Read. It's one of my favorite podcasts.
Sure.
But seeing them on the
God.
Video, it's just so much better.
Oh yeah,
especially Kid Fury. I don't know why,
so
he
good.
Just cracks me up generally. He's
so good,
too goddamn funny.
Yeah. So I think that brings us to the end of the show. I did want to just mention again, thank you so much to our guests. Oh my gosh,
Joma was so awesome.
She's the best. So awesome. She's just fantastic. And
do we ever go to Seattle? We have other people we could.
You
visit
always
Seattle.
Trying to go visit everybody. She didn't invite us. So don't try
I'm
to.
I'm saying Seattle sounds
but
cool.
But she didn't invite us to Seattle. You just invited yourself.
I didn't say that. I didn't say that
you
at all.
Why mention it?
Spurious coincidence.
Okay. We're going to be at your door front, apparently, Gioma. Just like, hey, what's up? We're here. Anyways, but we do.
Do you even know these people? All you do is on a podcast and Twitter. I'm just saying. You don't even know them.
Oh,
you don't even know them.
You have to wear a fur coat. Anyways, we do have some great shows coming up. This Saturday, we are going to be having as guests our wonderful brother and sister from the Great White North, Clove and Shirley from Chonilla.com.
They got a shade shout out from Rodimus Prime. Was that this week?
Yeah, they did. That was funny. Because of fucking Ted Cruz. So that's the Saturday next week. We're going to have our dude Black Rob on. And we are in the process of securing a date for Heck Philly to come on and talk about this Philadelphia Department of Justice report. Which we didn't mention today because I want to have Heck on to kind of delve in deep and get his more nuanced thoughts on it. But you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial Dawn. That's JAWN. And you can also find us on our website, interracialjohn.com. And you can also search on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or Tumblr at Interracial Dawn, JAWN. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mac. That's MAC. And you can find that idiot over there at very white guy.
Was that on fleek today?
You were good today, baby.
Was my whiteness on fleek, though?
Whiteness was, well, we had to check you a few times, but you're good. you got it all right. You're all right.
Very, very good.
Good night, everybody.
High five.